Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. So glad you're here with us. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina. AccuWindow forecast 75 degrees and clear. By the way, tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, the International Space Station should come over. So you might want to give a gander at that. The solar wind is a medium 327.4 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1112 is connected to a vast network of dark magnetic filaments looping around the sun's southeastern limb. It'll be coming at us all day tomorrow. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory is monitoring the situation. Filaments such as these have a habit of erupting. And will the fact that they are rooted in a sunspot make them more or less stable? Nobody knows. The magnetohydrodynamics of sunspots is so complex, not even the most powerful supercomputers on Earth can predict when they will erupt. Interesting that perhaps maybe the ancients did. Hey, also, should let you know, the U.S. Air Force's X-37B, you know, the space plane, it's gone missing. Amateur satellite watchers who routinely monitor the secret mini-shuttle failed to sight it at the expected times on October 7th and 9th. It's possible that the X-37B has landed. More likely, the space plane has maneuvered into a new orbit and will be recovered again in the nights ahead. You remember that its mission was to be 9 months long. Nobody knew how much was spent. Nobody knew what technology was on board. It's just interesting that lots of people that watch it come around into the northern hemisphere noticed it missing. Virgin Galactic's space tourism rocket, Spaceship Two, achieved its first solo glide flight today, marking another step in the company's eventual plans to fly paying passengers into space. Spaceship Two was carried aloft by its mothership to an altitude of 45,000 feet and released over the Mojave Desert. After the separation, Spaceship Two, manned by two pilots, flew freely for 11 minutes before landing at an airport runway, followed by the mothership. In the latest test, Spaceship Two did not fire its rocket engine to climb to space. Spaceship Two, built by famed aircraft designer Burt Rutan, is based on a prototype that won a $10 million prize in 2004 for being the first manned private rocket to reach space. Tickets to ride aboard Spaceship Two cost $200,000. No, the line's not short. Some 370 customers have plunked down deposits totaling $50 million, according to Virgin Galactic. And the FAA isn't excited, evidently. The launch base, it's in Mexico, where Homeland Security can't monitor it too closely. By the way, those of you that pay attention to YouTube, there was a 12-year-old boy that made a space launch recently, took his HD video camera, put it into a styrofoam cooler, hooked it to a helium balloon, started it recording, it went to 100,000 feet, filming the whole way, parachuted to the ground, and they recovered it a mere 30 miles away. Bravo, first 12-year-old astronaut. Although Obama made a large press release last month hailing a new $330 million expenditure for the famed Constellation program, NASA has advised contractors to anticipate reduced spending on the moon-bound Constellation program it plans to terminate, prompting a new round of contractor layoffs. Spending on Constellation, which includes development of the Ares 1 rocket and Orion crew capsule, is expected to decline as much as 25% for the 2 months ahead, according to NASA spokesman Michael Brukes. In an October 1st email, Brukes said NASA plans to immediately reduce its Constellation spending from an average rate of $282 million per month down to $212 million per month. By the way, during the Bush administration, when Constellation was still going strong, NASA contractors were anticipating that spending on the program would have ramped up to an average of $540 million per month by now. Looks like space exploration is not one of Obama's high priorities. The book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is now out in print, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere where good books are sold. You can also get it on Kindle and Nook, electronic versions, much less expensive. However, if you want the autographed copy plus the bonus of the audio version for free as a download, you have to order it from rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Coming times ahead could be unpredictable, could leave you in a situation where you have to leave home or office with nothing more than a backpack or in your car. It might be nice to have some supplies on hand. You might as well get something that's going to last for 25 years. You don't have to give it a second thought. Set it and forget it. Put it in a book bag with some old shoes, and you're ready to go. Our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com have put the packages together for you. Our good friend Paul Faust, former firefighter, and his partner, an EMT, have put together what we think is the most cost-effective, sometimes free shipping way of getting those supplies in your hand. Don't be a burden upon emergency supply crews. Get that stuff yourself and make yourself independent. 1-800-PREPARE.com. And then you can take care of yourself. And you might be able to take care of a couple of neighbors, too. Don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute version of the program. The more you click and the more friends you send there, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. Spread the word. We need something positive out there late night. All right. Fasten your seatbelts, because we have got a guest for you tonight. There are so many alignments happening in the next 2 years, it's hard to keep up with them. Eclipses with the moon, with Venus, and the sun are setting the earth up for what many ancient races have warned might be a great cataclysm or a great awakening. In any case, there are some who have made huge financial and political gain in this climate of uncertainty, but there are a few who have researched deep enough to know the potentials involved and how we, the human race, are not spectators of the cosmic events, but rather are participants. One of the leading experts in the world is here with us tonight to discuss his new book, The Choice. Mike Barra and I will be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to take off.
The spice extends to life. The spice expands consciousness.
Mike Barra is an aerospace engineering consultant, lecturer, and the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. He is a frequent speaker at venues including the Bay Area UFO Expo, Conscious Life Expo, and the CE4 UFO Conference in Roswell, New Mexico. And now, he is on X Squared Radio with us. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Brooks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is going to be fun. I read many parts of this book, The Choice, that you wrote twice. I got post-it notes sticking out all over it. I was fascinated and amazed at the depth of study you gave to the subject of the Mayan calendar, Egypt, the Hopi, and the events surrounding the auspicious date of December 21st, 2012. First of all, I got to say that your title is much more suited as The Choice than the sensationalized marketing plan called The Secret. Good job.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, it's interesting. I was with a friend at lunch, I guess last January, and I said, "What would you think about, you know, this line? You know, the secret. Now make the choice for this book." And she's young and kind of in that secret audience, and she really liked it. So I kind of realized that was the title. And as I got into the book, I didn't actually realize until the book was completed, and a friend pointed out to me actually just last night that I'm kind of living, you know, living the whole choice experience, and I started to think and just really understand that attraction is one, you know, significant force in the universe, but I think choice is far more powerful, and I guess to take it from to a really big, broad, from a metaphysical perspective, you know, people don't realize how much choice they really have, and part of this book was to point out to them that they have choice in everything, including the resolution of the apocalypse. They have choice and how that all comes out.
Sure, sure. I mean, I know a lot of people who think their lives are a little bit like a lab rat. Yes, we have a choice, left, right, dead end, back up. But, you know, really, when you think about human beings as opposed to every other animal on the face of the earth, with the exception of maybe dolphins and whales, we're really the only ones that do have choice.
Yeah, and, you know, and I don't think we put it to use enough. And you know, I mean, really, my point, this book is not just purely a metaphysical book, like about how to get rich, like The Secret. I mean, there's some of that stuff in there because this all sort of flows out of it. But, you know, what I'm trying to say to people is that choosing, you know, choosing your reality, not simply wishing for things, wishing for money to buy a boat or something, is much more powerful. Choosing not just for yourself, but choosing for your community, for your family, for your friends, and for the planet as a whole. And I'm just trying to get people to say to themselves, "Wow, I guess I do have a choice. I don't really have to go back to that waitress job tomorrow if I really don't want to, because every moment in time is a brand new moment, and it's never happened before. And even though there's cycles in history, clearly there's things that repeat, there's alignments that repeat, the bigger picture of the universe and its movement, its forward movement, which is time itself, is constantly different. So even though we may have lined up with the galactic core like we are right now many, many times before in the history of this planet, it's never been quite the same as this alignment. So therefore, we have a choice in how this particular version of this alignment, this particular version of this transitional period comes out.
Sure. I mean, there aren't, you know, just the alignments of planets and stars and where the solar system is in relation to the Milky Way, or where the Milky Way is in relation to other planets. There's also the presence of almost 7 billion sentient beings on the planet. There's that alignment as well.
And all of us pumping out about 100 watts of energy, and, you know, what most people don't realize, that's in any given moment of creation, you are pumping out about 100 watts of electrical energy. And the truth is that, you know, people don't really grasp that inside of a 100-watt light bulb, there's enough atoms that if you split them, you would have more nuclear power than all of the arsenals that this planet has ever seen all combined. So, you know, that's each one of us, and to underestimate or to discount the amount of power that all that spiritual energy has to make change, it is a big mistake, because we really do have tremendous power, and I think we really do ultimately get what we ask for.
Well, we're going to get into, I really want to get into the physics of the electrical nature of the human body, really of everything, trees, you know, animals, even the planet itself. I think it's distinctly possible, and I think you'll agree with me, that the presence of the being inside, the embryonic or the piece of source or God that's inside of us, makes us, you know, perhaps even in more command of that power that's inside of us, that electrical energy, because it's not just, you know, fight or flight that generates the amplitude of that energy. We have passion. We have desire behind that energy.
Yeah, we have intent behind that energy. And that, again, that's something that most other animals, I guess, really don't have a whole lot of. They're, you know, they're here to support us and to support other creatures around them. And they all sort of serve a support function. And really, you know, everything on the planet exists to support our existence as the highest form of life on this planet. And a lot of environmentalists don't like that. They don't want to believe that. They don't like people very much. But truthfully, I think the way the whole thing is structured, and we're already way into the physical part of this conversation, but you know, truly we are, you know, we're important to the God that's out there and each one of us. And you know, how our lives turn out does matter. It matters not just to us and to the people around us and the people that love us, but it matters to the universe too. So, you know, we should not abdicate the responsibility of choice that we have.
Well, that's true, and then there's evidence that we've got it wrong a few times. You state in the book that the fabric of modern physics, as it were, was woven by Newton and Einstein. What kind of holes have we found in the fabric of physics in modern times?
Well, you know, Newton had certainly some really great ideas early on, and he put a lot of pen to paper and came up with a lot of fascinating mathematical equations that seemed to explain in a limited way a lot of reality. But to me, the guy who really was the father of modern physics was James Clerk Maxwell. And because Maxwell's work, which it unified, you know, electricity and magnetism, in other words, it became, you know, electromagnetism. It became one sort of combined force in the universe under his equations. But what most people don't realize is that in the history, the deep history of what Maxwell actually did, is that he couldn't get everything to work working with just three dimensions of space. So he came up with a fourth dimension of space to make all of his equations work. And there was another physicist at the time, Oliver Heaviside, who was quoted as saying that he found the higher dimensional components of Maxwell's work to be, quote, mystical, and they should be murdered from the theory. So when Maxwell died, that's exactly what Heaviside did, and he stripped out this higher dimensional component. This was a time when the real separation between science and spirit, between, you know, mysticism and religion and science was taking place, and there were very strong advocates on either side, and Heaviside was definitely not the kind of guy that was going to support anything that would imply the existence of a God or a higher self or a heaven or anything that we couldn't see in the tangible material 3D universe. So what consequently happened was that the equations that are taught as Maxwell's equations are in fact Heaviside's equations, not Maxwell's. And unfortunately, because they took out the higher dimensional component, everybody who came after that, including Max Planck and Albert Einstein, the fathers of quantum theory and relativity, were working with a limited subset of the true reality of this universe, and they never, ever could fully explain everything that they could observe. So we ended up with a lot of mistaken beliefs, I think, about physics, and that's kind of driven us to the point where we now have Stephen Hawking, you know, claiming that the laws of physics, which are really a series of incorrect assumptions, somehow dictate that there's no such thing as God. And that, if that doesn't tell you that you're completely off track and you've lost your way, I don't know what does.
Well, it's just one other form of high priest stepping in and asserting his religiosity and whatever we call science. But it doesn't really stop the scientist from noticing that something in the universe is ringing, and nobody in this dimension struck the bell, which means that the energy has got to be coming from somewhere, and it's outside the three dimensions that we claim exist. And so has the physics community fabricated terms or the existence of things in order to make up the difference between what we see, in other words, the empirical reality of the universe, and what has been theorized?
Well, yeah, I think that's what they do, you know, in the choice in the physics chapter. And I don't want to give people the wrong impression that this is either a purely metaphysical book like The Choice or that it's some sort of physics text. It's not, but I do get into the physics of the solar system and how I think it really works and stuff. But, yeah, they actually do. They keep moving the goalposts to kind of make their theories work, and they keep, you know, doing things that really end up, I think, making them look ultimately quite silly. Because let's talk about something called dark matter. This is, to me, one of the best examples of the mindset, because what you have here is a situation where we do know that mass, in other words, something that's big and massive like a star or a planet, generates gravity, and it generates a certain amount of gravity. The more mass, the more gravity it generates. So that should make it fairly easy to look around the universe and say, okay, we see this much mass, and there should be this much gravity, and that's what holds everything together. The problem was, when they did that, they found that there wasn't nearly enough mass in the observable universe. It was missing like 70% of the mass, the matter, the solid stuff, that was necessary to be holding everything together. So at that point, you have a choice. You can either say, and again, this is a choice, like the choice. At that point, you have a choice. You can either say, well, gosh, maybe there's something wrong with our theory. Or you can say, well, no, there can't be anything wrong with our theory, because we know that the universe is a closed system and there's no energy being brought in from anywhere else. There's no fourth dimension. So therefore, I've got it. All the matter that's supposed to be out there, the massive stuff that we don't see, must just be invisible. And we'll call it dark matter, and then we'll go out basically trying to, like, set about proving that dark matter exists. So that's the problem. And the problem is, the universe, the system's not closed. You know, their theory, the conventional theory, is that that all the energy that ever existed in this universe was present at the Big Bang. And what I'm saying, and what other people are saying, and what some physicists like Michio Kaku and Nassim Harriman are starting to talk about, is that, well, maybe the system's not completely closed. Maybe there's a way to get energy from somewhere else. Now, they don't know what that is. I think I do. Now, I know how to get to that energy, and Richard Hoagland does, certainly the guy who originally came up with some of these theories. But, yeah, what happens is you ultimately end up with really making kind of a fool out of yourself by trying to you know, follow the established orthodoxy, as opposed to simply saying, yeah, maybe we're just wrong about this. Maybe we really don't know how everything works. And, of course, what's really holding everything together is this higher dimensional energy, this force from somewhere higher than this universe. You could call it, I guess, just call it the hand of God. That's basically what holds everything together.
Excellent. Well, it's crept its way into other sciences as well. I mean, you don't shy away from the use of God in the book, but we have been pummeled, it seems, by anthropology over the last 20, 30 years. So, help us understand the Darwinian delusion you talk about in your book.
Well, you know, what struck me as I wrote this book, what struck me as I thought about these things and looked around, was just the absolute beauty and perfection of everything that's out there. The beauty of this planet, the beauty of the universe itself. It's this compellingly, violently beautiful place out there in space. And you see basically things you can't even imagine. You know, I think it was Clark who said the universe is not only stranger than you can imagine, it's stranger than we even can imagine. And yet in all of that, there's an order, there's a symmetry, there's a balance, and there's a perfection. And I think what happens is that when you don't believe that there's anything higher than this three-dimensional materialistic existence, then what happens is you begin to, I think your soul gets kind of sick, and you end up essentially, you know, reaching conclusions like human beings are just some sort of random accident that were cobbled together by, you know, time and random events, and that there's no design or pattern or purpose. And so what I call the Darwinian delusion is this notion that we just somehow evolved by some sort of random process into these incredibly complex, sophisticated, spiritually touched creatures, you know, and that's just, that can't possibly be true. And I try to give many examples in the book of why that's not true. So part of the choice is about getting people to simply wake up and get in touch with that inner part of themselves, that higher part of themselves that is connected to the great beyond, and that can prove to you in your heart that you are not some sort of animal or machine. And in fact, animals aren't animals in the sense that we think of them. They have spirits, sure. They have souls. They're connected just in the same way that we are.
Right. Now, and I want to talk about this a lot deeper as we get into the third hour. We'll kind of tie all this together and you know, assure our listeners that in exploring the Earth and the mysteries of the universe, ultimately what it does, it leads us to a better understanding of ourselves and our purpose and maybe even our significance in the system of energy that makes up this universe and perhaps other universes. And that's where the real value of this whole exploration to the science and also, as it were, the spirituality of it. You know, just by way of foundation, you mention in the book correctly that God is mentioned many times in the Bible, but the plural form of Elohim is only mentioned 30 times. Why do you think that is?
Well, because okay, and again, we're getting more off into the ancient mystery stuff and Zechariah Sitchin stuff, but the Bible, remember, is a derivative of earlier stories, Sumerian stories, and even stories from other sources, and I think that the time when they're talking about Elohim or Elohim, they're talking about the all-loving God force that is all around us all the time, and that those of us that really do spend some time to think and pray and meditate and get into our hearts, you know, it's easy to feel. It's easy to feel that presence when you're tapped in properly. So that's the real God. That's the God force that we're talking about. The other guy, who they refer to frequently as the Lord God or Yahweh Elohim, is, as near as I can tell, he's some dude who showed up here with a bunch of other big dudes probably several hundred thousand years ago, and they were here doing along the lines of what Sitchin was talking about, mining gold for probably for its health purposes, the health benefits of it, or for some other reason. And they were hanging around here and, you know, kind of took over the place to a certain extent and for a certain time. So I think that there's a big difference between gods with a small g who appear, if you look at these ancient texts, appear to have been here in the distant past, and the big G, God himself, which is this powerful, fatherly force of love that we can all feel when we get in touch with our hearts.
Exactly. And I don't want to get off too much into the ancient mysteries and the Sitchinites and Anunnaki and all of that. I was just trying to, you know, lay some foundation. And the reason I want to do this is because what you've done in the beginning of the book here is you make a great case for the presence of something in the human being called life force, something that drives us to keep histories, to make comparisons, to ever improve, to care, and even to war. But there's a life force that has been somewhat documented, albeit by mistake. Tell us about Curlian. I have a lot of people ask me about that. What's Curlian photography? What does it mean? you do a pretty good explanation of it in your book.
Well, Kirlian photography is just it's a process of electrifying, you know, an electrostatic plate with a highly charged electricity, and then, you know, sticking your finger or laying a living like a leaf or something like that on the plate, and basically it creates a flash or an imprint on the plate when you I don't know exactly what they do to expose it, but this has been discovered. I think it was discovered in the 1930s by Samuel Kirlian, who was, I believe, Ukrainian, and it's been labeled Kirlian photography. And what it seems to show is this glowing life force or energy around human bodies that are touching the plate, around even severed leaves and, you know, objects that have been living before, like plants. And it's really difficult to explain in any sort of standard terms. And what some people say is what you're seeing there in this photography is you're seeing the human aura, the life force around us that connects us to the ether, which is the source of God, or the source of all life. So there have been a lot of experiments with it. There are the usual suspects who say that, oh, you're just seeing moisture, you know, coming off of the plant or coming off of somebody's finger, and it's, you know, once it evaporates, then you're going to see that image disappear. And of course, there's some images that everybody, I think, knows about where they'll take a plant and they'll cut it and they'll lay it down and photograph it, and you can see where the area where the leaf used to be that's been cut is still there, but it's beginning to fade away. And, you know, the idea that it's moisture is pretty silly because they never lay the leaf back down in the same place again, yet they get this image of it fading away. And it's just one of those things where it seems to be showing some sort of different electrical output or some sort of energy field that we are all generating. I mean, there's examples of when couples were fighting, and they took, you know, they put their fingers on the plate, and when the photograph was taken, their auras were not joined. But when they were saying romantic things to each other or kissing, the auras just melded together. There's another example of people being photographed after having had acupuncture, and the energy points where they were pierced for the acupuncture were just super bright in this Kirlian photography. So it seems to be something that basically photographs the aura that's around all of us.
Well, I have had other thinkers on this program, Dr. Bruce Lipton and others, who have, you know, mentioned this electrical being, this electrical energy image of the biological being. And I've asked the question to them, and I want to ask it to you. Do you think that the electromagnetic image precedes the biological being, or do you think somehow the pattern is it somehow the pattern into which the biological information flows?
That's an interesting question, and I hadn't asked that. I mean, I have to really understand the process of birth and you know, more than just the mechanics of it, just the physical mechanics of it. I would be, to me, you know, everything in this universe is light. The first line, you know, when God said, "Let there be light," there was light. So what I think happens is that the light comes in, and the DNA is the programming. It's the software, and it says, okay, we're going to take this light energy, and we're going to construct this physical body that's going to look like this. And it starts to go to work, and the cells start to replicate. Now, that signal has to come first. The spark of life literally has to come first, because to me, that's what's channeling the information. That's what's sending the information from higher up to provide the instructions to create the body that you're eventually going to be born into. So I guess I would have to take the position that it's the electrical energy, the light that comes first, and the body comes second.
Yeah, I think so too. The question was formulated because I had asked the question, how do cells know how to differentiate? I mean, you start out with an injury, for instance, several different kinds of tissues are severed apart and then they heal. How do the cells know when they start dividing to fix this breach in the skin or some organ or whatever? How do they know what to become, epithelial cells or bone cells or whatever? And And Dr. Lipton said, well, they just go by the information of the cell next to them, you know, to get the information, whether they're going to be a bone or ligament or whatever. And I said, well, that brings up two more questions. And this is kind of where this came from, Mike. You have two cells that are right next to each other, and they're right at the interface between eye tissue and a muscle. So it has to make a choice, one or the other, and it's got to be perfect or you're going to end up looking out of a muscle of your eye socket instead of an eye. And
right.
And the other is kind of like it. What happens when you only start with two cells, the sperm and the egg? And Dr.
Yeah.
Lipton said, well, I'm glad you asked that question because there's an electromagnetic image of the fetus that the cells sort of fill in as they differentiate. And you mentioned in your book, The Curlian Photography, and by the way, you did a great description of, you know, how Curlian accidentally discovered it and how he chased after it and really, you know, brought it into, I think, mainstream. There's hardly anybody out there that doesn't know about aura photography or Curlian photography. I'm sure you can look it up on the internet and find out all kinds of stuff on it. But the
yeah,
main
but don't
thing
believe
is
on Wikipedia. So.
Yeah.
Just don't believe the part on Wikipedia. But yeah.
The main thing is that there is more to a living thing than meets the eye. There's this energy part of it. And I guess my question is, do plants and animals respond to human intention?
Well, the truth is, one of the things I talk about in The Choice basically proves that, yeah, of course they do. They do. They are receiving signals just like we're receiving signals from above at all times. One of the examples I give is the work of Cleve Baxter, where you know, he was basically a lie detector expert for the CIA back in the 1960s, and he was doing some experiments where he hooked a simple houseplant up, I think it was, up to a lie detector machine, and he was kind of just monitoring what the electrical activity of it was, because we all living things have electricity in us. We all have electricity flowing through us. And as he was doing this, he kind of casually thought to himself, you know, I think I'll burn one of the leaves on this plant and see what happens. And the instant that he did that, the instant that he had that thought, the lie detector went crazy. It just started jumping all over the place. The plant...
He didn't even start to burn it. He just thought he was going to burn it?
Thought he was going to burn it. He just thought, I'm going to burn it. And he intended to follow through with it. And the plant went crazy, and it knew somehow, consciously knew what he was going to do, and it was afraid, and it reacted to that. And,
wow.
You know, he went on and did a great deal more work on this. He eventually found that the plants actually understood the true intention. So if he tried to fake the plant out and say, oh, I'm going to burn this leaf, without really intending to follow through with it, the plants didn't react. They didn't get upset. It was only when he was really determined to do it that they begin to get upset and have feelings and be apparently react to this. So no living thing wants to be injured. No living thing wants to be hurt. I mean, I think that must mean that everything feels pain to some extent. And that's fascinating, and it's really indisputable. I mean, there's a lot of things in The Choice that the mainstream science guys try to shoot down and try to attack. But Baxter's work is one set that they really can't say anything about. And, you know, it's interesting, Brooks, because one of the things, when I wrote Dark Mission with Richard Hoagland, and we would have these long debates, and what would always happen was, with our critics, is that no matter how many examples you might show of what something that's obviously an artificial structure on Mars or on the Moon, they would always say, well, but where's another one? I need another one. I need more of this. Or, you know, how many of those can there be? There has to be a city all around this kind of a thing. And the thing about that argument is that, no, you only need one. You only need one white cow to prove that all cows are not brown. And really, if we had nothing else except Cleve Baxter's work to prove that there is a connectedness between every living thing and I think every animate or inanimate thing on this planet, if we had nothing else but that one example, that consistently repeatable, proven over and over again example, we would still have all the proof we would ever need that there is a life force and a life energy all around us,
sure,
and that we are connected to it at all times. And ultimately, I guess the source you would call it would be God, whether God is a consciously intending entity or just pure love. I don't know.
Well, maybe we need to put a rubber tree in all of the courtrooms and wire it up. Truth detector.
Good idea. It's a good idea.
I've thought about this, though. Do you think it's the matter, the actual physical matter that makes up the plant or the animal that's responding to the intention? Or do you think it is the being, that electromagnetic being that is responding and the effect of that response?
It's the being. It's the spirit. I mean, I would call it the spirit. Electromagnetic being. It's the spirit. It's the conscious part of the plant that is understanding and reacting. It's okay. Feeling the vibration. It's feeling the waves through the force. You know, I hate to use the word the force, but really the way George Lucas describes the force in the Star Wars movies is the best example of the way things I think really work that I can think of.
It
so
very well could be a no small amount of thought went into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that what happened in that example is Baxter's intent created a tremor in the force, which the plant felt instantly, faster than the speed of light, and reacted to in fear. And wow, if that doesn't tell you how important, you know, your thoughts and your feelings are, I don't know what does.
Well, you know, I from A New Hope all the way to, you know, Empire Strikes Back and on through, I understood the Force very well. But when The Phantom Menace came out and they brought in the midichlorians and how that presence of that symbiotic microorganism in the bloodstream is what gives the human precognitive ability, that force, that kind of deflated it a little bit for me. I think they could have just left that out. I understood the force perfectly well in the first three movies, and then
I agree with you. It's kind of funny, and isn't that the? I was just watching a horror movie today earlier on I guess the Sci-Fi Channel, and don't all horror movies start to fall apart when you start have like they start to explain to you what the ghost is and how it got there, and you know. Maybe there's just certain questions we shouldn't ask. I don't know where in the body, you know, the spirit is housed, and it doesn't. If it is physically housed here, and I don't know that it really matters. What matters is that we all start to believe and understand that it really does exist, that we really do have this inside of us, and that the more in touch we are with that part of ourselves, the better our lives will be, because our choices will be directed in a direction that is going to result in happiness for us.
Yeah, I agree. And if you don't want to, you know, have that, you know, guessing who the villain really is kind of drive, stop watching Scooby-Doo, because that's really where all that's kind of undone.
Scooby-Doo will completely, because you can figure out anything after you learn Scooby-Doo, right? You know, it's pretty easy to figure out who the villain is after that.
Well, you know, I ask people, what is the largest living being on Earth?
The Earth itself, I guess. But you know, if you want to talk about an animal, one of the coral reefs or something. Would that be?
Oh, I never thought about that. I was thinking more of the aspen forests of Utah. All the root systems are interconnected. It is one being that covers all those mountains.
Oh, that is truly amazing. I hadn't thought about it in that context.
I used to ride my motorcycle up around the Alpine Loop before I moved away from that state. And I got to tell you, the serenity of just being in the presence of a being that ancient that has, you know, that level of perpetual life about it. It's really something. It's quite awe-inspiring.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I climbed Mount Baldy back in July, and I had some really interesting experiences there. And just sort of understanding and feeling the vastness of everything, and understanding that it's all connected. It must be amazing. I didn't realize that was all one big interconnected forest. That's truly, truly amazing stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know about the coral reefs. The coral reefs may be bigger than the aspen forests of Utah.
One of them is bigger than the other, but it doesn't matter. They're both enormous, and they're both stunning in their complexity and their perfection.
Well, you know, one of the questions comes up, and this has profound ramifications in physics. You know, there are those that go through life acted upon by the universe, and there are others who act upon it. The difference, I guess, between being a spectator and being a participator, I guess I would call it, different kinds of taters, as we talk about in the South. And I think it's more the one that's doing the acting upon, whether it's the universe or whether it's the individual, whether it's the aggressive predator or the prey, that has the effect. But how large can these effects be? You mentioned in the beginning of the program that the human being emits between 100 and 150 watts, I guess, depending on whether you've got a clue or not. How large can these effects be? I mean, if one person does it, is it as powerful as if 144,000 people do it, or a million?
Well, I would say not necessarily, but the truth is that that's a good question that we don't really know the answer to. But one of the things I talk about in the choice, in the physics, is that when you have certain days of the calendar, certain sorts of stellar alignments, like there's ones coming up, the seventh day of the Mayan calendar begins, I believe, November 2nd of this year. And then December 21st, we have an eclipse taking place exactly 2 years before the end of the Mayan long count calendar cycle. Those particular days are, in the physics, it appears to me, opportunities that where your intent and your energy that you put out is dramatically amplified. So, in other words, one person's intent, one person's desire, one person's wish for his planet could have a lot more powerful effect on one of those days and at one of those times than it would at any other time and at any other place. So you might be able to get 10 people to have more power than 144,000 on a given day and at a given time. So it varies, and that's one of the things that, again, in the book and the choice that I talk about is how the laws of physics are not consistent. They are changing because the physics of the planets around us and the stars around us are what generates the energy field that we exist in, and that amplitude and that effectivity is always changing. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. So, the more people, though, that are thinking along the lines that they need to be thinking as we head into this 2012 era, this transitional period that we're going to go through, the better things will be. The more people that are in touch with their hearts and are really, operating from their hearts, the better everything will be, because I think the intent of the planet is going to be really, really important as we head into this next few years.
Well, that alignment, that, shall I say, coordination of focused human intention on a single item, and these alignments, I think, is pretty profound. And we're not the first ones to think of it. What is the Flynn effect?
The Flynn effect is fascinating. This is something that that my co-author on Dark Vision, Richard Hoagland, pointed out to me, and he had what I thought was the really seminal observation about it. The Flynn effect is named because there's a anthropologist named, is it Jim Flynn? I want to say it's Jim Flynn from Northwestern University, who started studying IQ tests. And his original intent was to prove that there was no difference in human IQ potential between the races. And not only did he not find that out, he found out there was some difference. But what he started to notice is that overall, worldwide, IQ scores got higher and higher and higher. And on many IQ tests, there are multiple choice questions. And on other IQ tests, they tell you just give your best guess if you don't know the answer. So what was happening is that all these people's, the answers of people over the last 20, 30, 40 years have been getting more and more accurate. In other words, IQs are going up, and it's not because of computers and video games and the internet. It's simply because people themselves are getting smarter. But as Flynn himself pointed out, if that was really true, if the effect that was named after his research was really true, then why aren't we in a modern renaissance? Why aren't we curing all these diseases? Why aren't we all so much smarter and so much, why aren't we all, creating marvelous, amazing things out of our intellect that's supposed to be getting so much better? And the answer to that is that what's happening is people really aren't necessarily getting smarter. What's happening is that human intuition is accelerating. And that's another thing that the ancient Mayan calendar pointed out about this time in history, is that we we would start to get more and more intuitive as we got reconnected to our hearts and started listening to, you know, the songs of God more than listening to the thoughts in our heads. So what seems to be happening is that people are scoring higher on IQ tests because they're guessing a lot more accurately than they used to be. And that has really profound implications for what's going to happen to us in the next few years.
Well, these guesses, these periods where the IQ is bumped, as it were, is it linear, or are there particular times when this is particularly more noticed?
Well, actually, this is really interesting. One of the things, again, that I talk about in The Choice is that there was some research done on ESP, which is a basically human intuition. And Stanford Research Institute and some other institutions have done a lot of studies on ESP over the years. And one researcher, whose name sadly escapes me right now, decided to sit down and see if there was any pattern to ESP test scores. And what he found was that at 1330 local sidereal time, human intuition, ESP, seemed to jump pretty much off the charts. It got much, much stronger, much, much more powerful. So basically a period of time between 12 noon local sidereal time and 1330, which would be 1:30 p.m. local sidereal time, people basically got more, their ESP went up, they got more intuitive, and they really couldn't understand why. Now, what local sidereal time basically measures, to really oversimplify it, is it measures pretty much when, from your local position, the constellation of Sagittarius is most directly overhead. That's really an oversimplification. That's basically what we're talking about. Now, that's important for one reason and one reason only. Somewhere in the constellation of Sagittarius, they think near Sagittarius A, a star they call Sagittarius A, is the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And it is spinning at an incredible rate of speed. And again, the whole thing about the physics in The Choice is that spin energy is what creates life force. So what happens is, it's almost like, it'd be like you're trying to read a piece of paper, read some writing on a piece of paper, and it's really dark and you really can't see it, and all of a sudden this big bright flashlight comes and flashes down on the piece of paper, and all of a sudden you can see clearly what the words are on the page. That's what seems to happen during this particular time of day. Now, here in L.A., where I live, I think that that is about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. Somewhere between 9 and 11:15 at night is when we are in that perfect alignment with the center of the galaxy. And that's when people should really sit down and set their intention for themselves, for their family, their friends, the community they live in, and the world around them. And that will, that is when the research says it will be the most effective.
You know, I just find this fascinating because I really didn't know. I mean, by the way, it's Dr. James Spottiswood. You have it in your book.
Spottiswood, yeah. Thank you.
It's hard to recover all that.
If Richard's listening somewhere, he's cursing me for not remembering that, because he always remembers that stuff.
Well, I didn't know what local side real time was. So I'm glad that you've now correlated that. Proctor told me one time that the secret to life is clean glassware and conversion factors. So now I have that. But that puts that around between 2 and 2:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I don't know how many of you, I'd really like to know, if you want to call in, by the way, if you're off planet, and can get to a cell phone tower, it's 530-413-4511. If you're east of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And west of Earth, 530-413-4520. Call in and let me know what goes on in your life between the hours of 2 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the morning. Do you wake up in the middle of the night the middle of the morning, with all these wonderful ideas popping and racing through your head? This reminds me of a really funny story. It's a friend of mine who served in Iraq, and they were out on a night recon mission, and one of their guys who had a radio got separated from the rest and got lost. And so they were in communication with him by radio, and they said, "Can you give us your location? We'll come and get you." He said, sure, no problem. I'm under the moon now. That was so funny. Anyway, that reminds me of that. You know, he's under the moon now. Of course, his CO said, "You stupid idiot, we're under the moon too. Can you get us a little
more?" Everybody's under the moon at the same time, right? It's almost as if you come into the beam of a flashlight during that time, and your mind and your heart open up, and you can trust your gut feelings at that moment more than usual.
People would ask, you know, what's the frequency? What is coming in at that time? What is it that makes us better guessers at that moment in time?
Well, what I talk about in the book is that, you know, there's all these different forces in physics, and there's some that they call fictitious forces. And again, I went into the laws of physics and how they all kind of really don't add up. They really they don't fulfill the expectations. But what I say is that there's a force out there called torsion, which is actually the real physical force that drives everything in the universe, and it's sort of a twisting, spinning, left to right, spiraling movement. Picture a spiral staircase, kind of an image, and going from left to right out of your heart. And that's what time is, and that's what the universe does. That's the direction the universe moves in, and everything seems to adhere to this torsion physics. So what you're really getting in the path of is a torsion beam, a wave of torsional energy coming from the black hole at the center of the galaxy. Now, the interesting thing is they say it's a black hole, but, you know, there's this argument that there may be such a thing as a white hole, which is what you've got energy coming out as opposed to everything, including light, being sucked in like you have with a black hole. And I tend to think that whatever these objects are at the center of galaxies that are creating the galaxies, I think, and putting out all the energy for them to exist are not sucking energy in, but rather pushing energy out. And it's that energy that we're catching is just something called torsion. And torsion's it's a fairly complicated thing to explain, but I of course simplify it pretty well in The Choice. But what we're really talking about is that everything spins, and it is the spin which gates energy in from higher dimensions. And so we're basically, it's like getting a gentle breeze from the universe to sort of just cool you down and wake you up.
Well, I like that, actually. Now, for the reason we set this in motion this early in the discussion tonight, we're going to go into this a lot more in the next hour, is that we're about to crack open a huge physics problem. You don't want to go away. We're going to take a quick 4 or 5 minute break here, get a drink of water, loosen your seatbelt a little bit, because we want you to be prepared so you can see how the human race fits into this and how this spinning energy is responsible for a lot more going on out there than you might imagine. Don't go away. We'll be back in about 5 minutes with more X Squared Radio. My guest, Michael Barra. Thank you. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We are coming to you live from Western North Carolina. The book we're discussing tonight is The Choice, author Mike Barra. Also, he's a New York Times best-selling co-author of Dark Mission with his friend and colleague Richard Hoagland. Is there reason for concern about the apocalyptic prophecies of the Mayan calendar? And is there an underlying physics driving these changes? How do planetary alignments and astronomical events such as the ones predicted in 2012 affect your consciousness? Well, we are about to find out in hour two of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Brooks. Thank you.
By the way, I don't mean to call you Michael. If you want to be called Mike, we'll just stick with
It's not debatable. It's interesting. The women in my life tend to call me Michael, and I kind of like the soft version. I'll always go with the feminine influence when I can. But, you know, it just came out Mike in Dark Mission, so now I guess that's my official, pen name is Mike Barra. That's the way we'll go. And yeah. Of course, when you're looking for me on the web, it's MikeBarra.com, MikeBarra.com. And that's where you can, by the way, where you can order the book. You can order The Choice. Or you can go to BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com, and it's Barra with just one R. I know it sounds like it would be something different than that, but it's MikeBarra.com.
Now, if they buy it from your website, does it come autographed, or just, I know it doesn't do Amazon.
No, I don't have any of that stuff yet. I actually have, I've got some stuff coming up. I'm going to do a book signing and a lecture at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles here next Sunday at 4 p.m. And you can certainly get one signed then. And after that, we're kind of having a party in Hollywood to launch it. And it's going to be coordinated with a friend's film called The Apocalypse According to Doris. We're going to put together a couple of events the week of the 20th of October. And then after that, I will get some books from my publisher, sit down, sign them, and put them for sale on my website. But it probably won't be till November.
Now, you've got a documentary coming out, right?
Yeah, I'm working also with a production company that I'm involved with here called Asgard Media, and we've shot a bunch of stuff at last year's Conscious Life Expo with people like Marianne Camerato and Sean David Morton and Daniel Brinkley about kind of what they think is going to happen in 2012. And so we're going to do, you know, take all that footage and put it together, and that's the next thing on my plate once I get the choice launched here in October. It's the next thing I'm going to work on, and hopefully we'll have it out by Christmas time.
Oh, very cool, very cool. Let me know if there's any way we can contribute to that.
Yeah, I'd love to have you. I'd love to have you be a part of it.
Well, yeah, I'd like to do it. My co-author and I, we wrote a little over 1,500 pages on the subject. We started in 2004, which that's one of the reasons I want to mention this. We talked about alignments in the book. Volume 1 of The Arc of Millions of Years has the Grand Sextile alignment on the cover because we worked on the books for about 3 years before we published the first one, and we were struggling for a cover for it, and the Grand Sextile alignment had happened that month, and with a lunar eclipse in the middle of it, and it's said that the last time that occurred, it heralded the birth of King Solomon, and there was a prophecy made at that time that the next time it occurred, the keys to understanding the creation of the universe would be revealed. We've sort of figured that we had done that with the book, so we put the Grand Sextile alignment on the cover of the book. And as you mentioned in your book, it's supposed to be a time of, you know, solar quiet, and yet we had 9 X-class flares within a couple of weeks of that alignment. It was really unexpected.
Well, it was unexpected in the conventional physics model, but it's not unexpected in the hyperdimensional physics model, because, you know, there was some work done by John Nelson, an RCA engineer back in the 1950s, who was asked by RCA to figure out why shortwave radio signals would vary in quality and strength from different times of the year. And what he came back with them was basically said, he said, it's the planets. Basically, when especially the big planets, the Jovian planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, when they're in certain positions in their orbits around configurations around the sun gets very quiet. And when they're in other configurations, the sun gets very active. And when it gets active, of course, it spews out these solar flares, and there's a magnetic activity, and it interferes with the shortwave radio signals. And he said to them, not only that, but they seem to coincide with astrological aspects, trines and sextiles. You know, positive aspects produced quiet on the sun and very low, amounts of magnetic output and solar storms, and very high quality radio signals. And negative aspects, oppositions and squares, produced exactly the opposite. The sun got very worked up, spewed out a lot of energy, and the radio signals were interfered with. And that did not make a lot of people very happy when he came up with that, but you know, his work stands. There's been some attempts to attack it, but that's the most, you know, compelling argument to me, for one of the most compelling arguments for hyperdimensional physics itself, because that's exactly what hyperdimensional physics says, is that the solar system is a system, it is all connected, and it also shows that astrology is real, it's valid, because, let's face facts, the concept of astrology is that, and I don't know, maybe I went off on a tangent here, but the concept of astrology is that the positions of the planets affect our thoughts, our moods, our feelings, and our lives to some great extent. It affects our consciousness. And if, in fact, the positions of the planets, their positions along their orbits, their geometric configurations, can affect electromagnetic energy like the sun's output, magnetic output, and shortwave radio signals, then they can also affect our thoughts, because our thoughts are nothing more than electromagnetic energy. That's what our brain waves are, is electromagnetic energy. So it's actually incomprehensible that other electromagnetic energy could be interfered with or affected, but our thoughts and our own emotions can't be. So to me, that's one of the coolest things that's in the book, is basically
Let's see if we could tie in.
Is real.
put all this together and in order, and let's see if we can make it make sense. So when people go back and listen to this again, they'll go, wait a minute, we jumped off into astrology, and what's he saying about the planetary alignments? Okay. You say in the book that this is a true solar system in the choice. Tell us what it means to be a true solar system.
Well, what it means is that if you buy into the conventional mainstream physics models, the only effect, the only force that really affects anything from a great distance is gravity. And we all know that gravity gets weaker and weaker with greater distances. Carl Sagan, famously...
I was taught in school that solar systems form out of these giant swirling clouds called accretion disks. And then we had the late Tom Van Flandern on this program a couple of times over the last few years.
Yeah.
And he discussed his solar fission theory. And it made sense to me, but it's a big, thick book, and it's hard to cover, especially with him and 3 hours on the radio. But you've done an excellent job of telling how he came to this idea of solar fission and what challenges he faced over his career as an astronomer with it. So let's tell that story and figure out once and for all, how did this solar system come to be to make it this system?
Well, to make it very short, and then we'll go into the deeper explanation, is I agree with Tom. I think that the planets are birthed by the sun, just like a mother gives birth to her babies, a cat gives birth to her kittens. Basically, like you say, the standing traditional model is that there are these big, nebulas, bunch of gas and dust and stuff that's all clumped together, and somewhere in the middle there, a bunch of stuff gets together and becomes attractive and starts to spin and it starts to collect more and more material, and eventually it gets so big and dense that it collapses and ignites into a star. And after that, what they say happens is that in other parts of that area around it, big clumps of rock and dust and gas sort of start to smash into each other, and they smash into each other repeatedly until they ultimately form planets. And that, that could work, it might work, and it might even work to a certain extent, but there's a lot of problems with it. And one of the problems is it doesn't really explain why all the planets would be in the same plane. In other words, there's something called the plane of the ecliptic, which basically is where all the planets are. They all orbit around the equator of the sun. Now, what Van Flandern's theory was is that it is something called the solar fission model, which is that basically the sun gets so big and so massive, and it has so much stuff in it, and it is spinning so rapidly, and then, in my opinion, gating so much energy down from these higher dimensions that it basically starts to spew big chunks of itself out of its belly, out of its equator, and then those big spinning balls of star stuff start to spin and cool, and they slowly but surely spiral away from the parent star, and eventually until they settle down into an orbit. And of course, along the way, they're going to be cleaning out more and more of this stuff and making a space for a new solar system to exist. So that's Van Flandern's theory, and it makes a lot of sense because you have these, as they started to look for planets around other stars, and they found them, they got really freaked out because what they found was these big, gigantic Jupiter gas giant planets right next to their parent stars. And in the mainstream accretion model theory, that can't happen. The big gas giant planets have to form far away because it's cooler out there and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And so basically what they were seeing is impossible in their theory, because they had these gigantic hot Jupiters. They're called that because they're so hot, they're almost the same temperature as the star, and they're within a few million miles of their parent star. And in Van Flandern's model, that makes complete sense, because what you're seeing is a brand new planet that just got ejected from the parent star and is just in the process, which probably takes millions of years, of slowly but surely moving farther and farther away, carried by this angular momentum, moving farther and farther away from its parent star. And, again, they can't explain it. There's not been a good explanation for it, and I don't think they ever will, because I think the accretion model is just wrong. And, again, this is another kind of, as I did the research for the book, I started thinking about this stuff. It's like there's a certain elegance to the universe that that to me, this fits perfectly. Why wouldn't stars give birth to planets in the same way that, you know, we give birth to our children? They're all our children, and that also explains why the sun has less of the spin energy in the solar system, because it gives it away. It gives that energy away to the large planets, the first planets it spews out, and eventually this whole interconnected system of planets and moons becomes like a gigantic solar family, really, is what it is.
Well, you know, the solar system has been here a lot longer than we have. We arrived late, cosmically speaking, and sure. In an effort to explain how this all happened to be the way that it is, the scientific community has relied a whole lot on two gentlemen, Newton and Einstein. And from there, we kind of made up what makes sense and
right.
What no one could publish against, I guess, until now.
You really can't publish against the mainstream. Your analogy earlier was absolutely correct in that the mainstream science is no better than the churches that they attack, because basically anybody who talks about spin or anybody who talks about higher dimensions is a heretic, and you're not even allowed to speak in their church. And that's really what it is. You're right. These guys have become priests of themselves.
Well, I mean, the idea that planets are ejected from the sun, you know, as it were, in pairs, robbing the sun of some of its energy, but still the sun, doesn't it hold like 99% of the energy of the solar system? How can 1% of the planets have such an effect on radio waves and the minds and moods of human beings if they only hold 1% of the energy of the solar system? What's missing from this?
The sun holds 99% of the mass in the solar system, and therefore the gravity, which is one important force in the universe, but the planets hold about 98% of the spin energy, what's called angular momentum. In other words, the spewing off of these planets and giving away her spin energy to them is what allowed the sun to calm down, quiet, burn consistently, and in a way that would allow her children, I guess like the Earth, to ultimately become habitable for higher forms of life. So it's really the spin energy that's important. I mean, in hyperdimensional physics, it's all about this spin energy, and that's what is held by the planets. Therefore, it makes sense that the planets would be able to have these effects from a distance the way that they do, and the way they measurably do using work like Nelson's.
Well, does the evidence show that all the planets that are in our solar system are the sun's children? Are any of them adopted, and are they all here?
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you bring that up. Dr. Van Flandern's model, what you would see is these big gas giant planets way out there that would have a bunch of smaller moons like they do, and then the closer in rocky terrestrial planets like the Earth would have one big moon. But I think you can make a really compelling argument that our own moon is actually artificial. It's not really from here. But again, in his model, it fits. Now, that doesn't mean that just because he's right about 85% of what he's talking about, that he's right about 100% of what he's talking about. So that's one interesting debate. But no, the other question you had is really significant, because there is another theory which was very popular in the 1800s and has since fallen into disfavor, that Dr. Van Flandern sort of brought back to the forefront, or at least tried to. And it's called the exploded planet hypothesis. And what that says is that there are at least two missing planets in this solar system, one where the asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter, and one right about where Mars is orbiting right now. And what that would imply is that Mars, in fact, is not a planet at all, but it's rather a moon of some other much larger planet which isn't with us anymore. And, you know, that's... You want to talk about heresy. That is about as heretical as you can get, because the implication of that information, which was at one time considered to be probably very likely, is that planets can blow up. And I really don't think, since we live on a planet, you know, the powers that be really want people to be worried about whether our planet's going to explode or not. So that's a big political problem right there.
Yeah, I reckon. I mean, even if they suspected that something like that could happen.
Yeah.
I don't think they would tell the general public, and I think there would be a massive increase, not a decrease, in the spending of NASA, although it can be argued there might be a secret space program that NASA has nothing to do with, and that's another show altogether.
Yeah, that would be Richard Hoagland's next book. That would be Richard's next book.
Exactly. Well, the idea that Mars was a moon of another planet, was Mars lush and green? Did it have oceans and an atmosphere and life on it?
Yeah, I argue in The Choice that there were once three planets in the solar system that could have supported human life. There's Venus, Earth, and Mars. And, you know, Mars, although technically it's a moon, I think. But what you had was a situation where you had an inner Earth, an outer Earth, and a middle Earth. So you had Venus, Mars, and the Earth itself. And unfortunately, something seems to have happened. The destruction of these other two planets seems to have created a lot of chaos. And I think it's Richard and I came up with a theory called the Mars Tidal Model back in 2001, T-I-D-A-L, tidal, as in tides and tidal forces. And the observation was really very simple. It started out with looking at these dark stains that appeared on images of Mars, and they looked like water. It looked like water under the ground was sort of, these water pockets were bursting and spreading out across the Martian landscape. And a young man that was looking at these, Richard told him, why don't you see if there's a pattern to this? And the pattern ended up being that you had all these dark streaks of what could be water on two really prominent features on Mars, the Tharsis Bulge and the Arabia Bulge. And there are these two very, very big uplifts of the mantle of Mars, and they're 180 degrees apart. Now, when you look around the rest of the solar system, every place that gravity exists, all the other moons that are out there, our own moon and the Earth itself, that is a absolute guaranteed 100% signature of a tidal lock condition, meaning exactly what takes place between the Earth and the moon. The moon has the same face to the Earth all the time because it is locked by our gravity. And what happens is because of the tidal forces that go on between the two bodies, there is a large bulge on the side that faces the Earth and a smaller bulge exactly the opposite of that, 180 degrees around the back of the moon, and that is the signature of this tidal lock condition. And you can look at all the moons of Jupiter, and they all have the same situation. And Mars does too. And there is absolutely nothing in any geophysical model where that kind of a configuration would exist, why a planet would look like that without a tidal lock condition. So simply by simple deduction of 100% of the evidence in the solar system, we can say that Mars was once in orbit in a tidal lock condition around a much, much larger parent planet. And that paper's on the web, and it's pretty extensively documented.
So that equatorial bulge, which remains in stasis in the equator of Mars, is a telltale leftover of Mars being the moon of another planet.
Right. And, I mean, you know, there's been all these, we've looked at all these pictures of Mars where there was clearly once vast flowing water, and then there's this one side of it that's just completely spattered with craters. There's just so many craters that you can't even count them. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that, well, that's the early ancient crust of Mars, and somehow the smooth upper northern hemisphere stuff somehow got blown away. And we think it's exactly the opposite, that that's really the new stuff, and that's just debris from this planet that exploded, you know, right next to Mars, probably 65 million years ago. And it seemed to have sent, probably would have sent, you know, large chunks of debris, basically asteroids, bombarding the inner solar system. And if you look at Venus, if you look at the radar maps of Venus, you can see this huge gash that basically goes about three-quarters of the way around the planet. And what it appears happened is that a large chunk of this stuff at thousands and thousands of miles per hour basically grazed Venus, carved out this huge fissure. And if there were oceans on Venus, it would have instantly boiled them and turned them into this incredibly thick, massive cloud cover that we have now. So that fits completely with what happened with Venus. And at the same time, the Earth got struck, although our impact was more direct, and it was the KT boundary event that, that wiped out the dinosaurs. So that's a lot of complex solar system history, but I put it in there in the choice. I put it in there because I wanted people to understand that the solar system is not the way it was originally configured. And so the life energy here is different than it used to be. That's why dinosaurs once roamed the Earth. They're much larger than human beings, and now we dominate the Earth because there's simply less spin energy, less life energy in the system that's being pumped out.
Now, you mentioned in the choice, and this is really important, Earth explorers, as we go here on out for the next hour and a half, to understand this, because this is going to help tie the physics and the metaphysics together. What is a harmonic system?
Well, a harmonic system is essentially an electrical system that operates. All systems together operate either in harmony or, well, in resonance or dissonance. A harmonic system is a system of connected, generally electrically interacting, whether they would be devices or even, I guess, people and plants, that are operating in harmony, in resonance, where everything is at the same frequency and all the information, all of the energy travels back and forth smoothly and without any issues. Now, in a dissonant system, a dissonant harmonic system, what you have is you have some of the parts that are not operating at the same frequency as the rest of the parts, and therefore the information travels more, it's more difficult for the information and the energy to travel back and forth between those particular parts. So the point in the book that we make in the choice is that, hey, this solar system is in dissonance because at least two planets are missing, and that has messed things up, and the Earth is tilted off its axis by 23.5 degrees. And that seems to be what we're trying to do with the whole solar system, is trying to get back into resonance. And it's natural for a harmonic system in dissonance to want to come back into resonance. And I think that's part of what's going on with this 2012 era that we're experiencing right now.
Well, that's interesting. As we look at, you know, what once was a solar system in perfect harmony with every planet where it should be in the orbit where it should be in proportion with the other planets in orbit around our sun. Now there are a couple of planets missing, so the whole chord that makes up the solar system, some of the notes are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And one would ask the question, can we recover as participants rather than spectators in this thing we call the harmonic solar system? Can we recover? Is it possible?
Yeah, I say it's possible. And, you know, one of the things that I like to say in my lectures, and I put in the choice, is that, you know, the apocalypse is not something that happens to you. It is something that you actively participate in. And so I think part of this resonance that we're trying to achieve, and it's a spiritual resonance as well as a physical resonance, is what this period in time is all about. We're trying to get back to a place where the system as it exists today can operate more naturally and more harmoniously with God and with the way things are supposed to be. And what's unfortunately happened to us as a culture is that, you know, we have become out of balance. We've become a little too, in some ways, we've become a little too masculine. In other ways, some of our cultures are a little too feminine. We've gotten, you know, we're very intellectual. We're not very much in our hearts. There aren't enough of us that are spending time helping the rest of us balance the material world with the spiritual world. So we do have to find a way to participate in this change and this desire to get back into harmony with the solar system and with ourselves. So it really, Brooks, it's really like two different sides of the same problem. You've got the physics problem and you've got the spiritual problem. But working on the spiritual end of things will make the physics end of things come out the way we want it to.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's very introspective. When we talk about spiritual end of it, we talk about meditation, we talk about prayer. Some people might think of, well, I need to go to church, I need to sing some hymns, do some rituals. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when we talk about physics, it's a very distant, almost isolating thought, that here we are, a mere 100 watts among a universe. You know, how can we have an effect? And besides, we're limited, you know, by the speed of light. You know, things cannot travel. There's no possible way we can keep it all in our mind or have any effect upon it. But you have this term, this hyperdimensional physics that you've mentioned already. And it sounded a little vague for me when I've heard it in the past, but you do a superb job of explaining it in this book, The Choice. How does energy and mass behave in this type of physics? And how does that sort of shrink the universe and make it more accessible to us and make us a much more integral, effective part of it?
Well, what's been found in experiments that have been done by people like Dr. Bruce De Palma and even Richard to a great extent is that basically what matters is spin. And if you take something, you know, an electrical system, a magnetic system, if you spin it fast enough, you are going to pull energy from these higher dimensions and put more energy into the system, get more energy out of the system than you put into it, which basically is impossible by all the modern theories of physics. So there's plenty of experiments which support this and prove it out, and what that means is, ultimately, is that we can build devices, if we're working and experimenting along the right lines, that give us power to do all kinds of things that would be considered basically unbelievable. You can circumvent the speed of light. You can negate the effects of gravity. These are all things that have happened in these experiments that were conducted by various researchers over the years. So when you have that kind of power, you can make dramatic changes to the physical environment you live in. But
well,
again,
let's talk about some of the details of that, like De Palma's a spinning ball experiment, for instance. Explain to people how spin, just something simple as spin, made such a profound difference in what should be an ordinary and very repeatable experiment.
Right, and let's just go to the laws of physics again. You know, there's three major competing, not really competing, but three major pillars upon which modern physics is based, and that is Newton, Einstein, and quantum theory or Max Planck's stuff. So they all work really great, except in very limited ways. Newton works great as long as you don't rotate anything. His equations fall apart when you put rotation into them. The problem is, of course, is that everything in the universe, including every single aspect of your body, is constantly rotating all the time. The planet's rotating on its axis. It's rotating around the sun. The sun is rotating around the center of the galaxy, you know, so on and so forth. Einstein's stuff works pretty good at the larger scale, as long as you buy into certain constants like the speed of light in a vacuum. And unfortunately, it falls apart at the smaller scale, which is where they had to come up with quantum theory. And quantum theory works great as long as you don't include an annoying little thing called gravity. Now, that's really the current modern laws of physics. That's what we're talking about. So what you have then is you've got these three theories that are kind of all broken in different ways. And I'm sorry, where were we going to go with this again?
My question was that we've got this term hyperdimensional physics.
Right.
We were talking about some practical experiments that have been done that should be, you know, just spinning something changes the way, for instance, the almost spinning ball experiment.
Right, so simply spinning something under the hyperdimensional theory, rotating stuff, should bring more energy into the system. So what Dr. De Palma did, and by the way, Bruce De Palma, his brother is Brian De Palma, the Hollywood film director, and Bruce was an MIT physicist. He worked with, I believe, Edward Land, who invented the Polaroid camera back in the 1960s. He worked for, you know, a lot of very, very high-level people and was certainly a genius as far as that goes. So there's really no question about his credentials or his talents. He just wanted to work with rotation, and, you know, basically the powers that be kind of put their arm around him and said, if you want to have a career in science, you really got to stop messing around with this stuff. And he said, well, I guess I don't want a career in science then. So he went off and did his own research. And one of the experiments he created was that he took two little metal spinning little metal balls, like a pinball. You get them out of a pinball machine. And he stuck them into a test rig. And one of them was completely static, just sitting there in the test rig. And the other one he spun at 27,500 revolutions per minute. So that is really, really, really spinning. Now, this was a lateral spin. It wasn't something that was, you know, it was just basically spinning around inside this container. And then what he did is he ejected both of the balls with equal force out of the test rig. And the one that was spinning, it rose faster, it went higher, and it went a farther distance, and it fell faster than the ball that was not spinning. So what you had in this experiment was basically a negation of the effects of gravity. The balls weighed exactly the same. They were ejected with equal force. And yet the one that was spinning somehow had more energy in it than the one that was not spinning. And there is nothing in Newton, nothing in any of the pillars or the laws of physics that can explain that. So we have
a really simple equation. Force is equal to mass times acceleration. We launch a ball on some kind of trajectory, and I'm assuming that the spin of the ball is not like backspin on a tennis ball or forespin on a tennis ball. It's spinning axially.
Yeah.
And it's launched on this trajectory. And for some reason, this force equals mass times acceleration seems to be missing a little bit of input because the ball travels further than the ball that's not spinning, meaning it pulled energy in from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, the other law that it kind of breaks is, you know, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Like the ejection of the ball straight up should according to that law, the spinning of the ball should not have any effect on it whatsoever. So I would say that you know, for every action there's not an equal and opposite reaction. If one of the things that's reacting is spinning, it's going to basically become lighter somehow.
I would argue that golf also is the antithesis of that for every
action. Exactly. Golf is the antithesis. And if we can spin our golf ball at 27,500 RPM before we hit them off the tee, what would that do for us?
Are there any rules in the game against that? Can we not spin the golf ball at like 40,000 RPM before we hit it?
Wow. You would have to have a little mechanical tee that would be able to keep the ball in place and spin it at that speed. Yeah, actually, not that I know of. They probably haven't thought of hyperdimensional physics when they were setting up the golf rules.
I know that there are rules about the club and the head and all that, but I don't think there are any rules on the tee. That's an interesting idea. All right, another program.
you going to test that one out for me here at some point, Brooks?
Yeah, maybe. Well, the point is that when you get a lot of mass spinning quickly, or a little bit of mass spinning really quickly, it had an unpredictable effect on what should be, you know, normal Achillean physics. Aim ahead of the turtle with the arrow, and by the time the turtle moves, the arrow will strike the turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Not so when attempting to go to the moon. So what the heck happened? How in the world did we ever figure out, how did we miss the moon by, like, I don't know, 10 diameters of the moon? It should be pretty simple.
This is a fascinating story. This really would have normally gone into, like, Dark Mission 2, because when Richard and I were talking about it, this is something Richard discovered back in, geez, I guess 2008. And he started by looking at Explorer 1, the first launch of the first satellite into space back in 1957 by Wernher von Braun. And what happened was is that they had this little tiny probe. It was about 30 pounds, and our rockets were very weak and flimsy back then, and we were trying to get something into orbit to match what the Russians had done with Sputnik 1. And so on this particular day, they launched the spacecraft, and, you know, it really the rocket equation is really pretty straightforward. You know, how much thrust you have, you know gravity, you know the effect of gravity, how it drops off as you get to higher altitudes. And you know what trajectory that's going to put your rocket into. Well, what happened was is that they were going to put it up there. They had a very primitive tracking system, and they said, okay, at exactly 12:30 a.m., we should get a signal from the Explorer probe if it's in orbit. So 12:30 came and went, and no signal. And then 12:32, and then 12:35, and then 12:40. And then at 12:41, 11 minutes late, all of a sudden, beep, 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 here comes the signal from Explorer 1. Now, that is flatly impossible. What had happened was is that somehow Explorer 1 had ended up 600 miles higher than it was supposed to. It had about a third more energy in the system than it was supposed to have. The orbit was a third higher than it was supposed to be, is another way to put it. Better way to put it.
All right, before we give the answer as to why that was 600 miles larger orbit than what they originally calculated, let's go through the rest of the explorers, because obviously, what was it, von Braun was involved in this, right? Didn't everybody turn to him and say, Werner, you missed the orbit by 600 miles there, guru. What's going on?
Right. Well, they made some lame excuses about, the jet stream and all these other things that they actually had accounted for and accurately accounted for. And as we went through the space program, there were more explorers that were sent up. The same thing happened again. We began to build other larger rockets and test them for some of the manned space program missions that were coming up. And what they eventually created was a probe called Ranger. And the purpose of Ranger was to be launched into orbit and aimed at the moon and then strike the moon. And because we wanted to make sure that we could hit the moon. Now, once you get into space, it's pretty easy to figure this out. There's virtually no gravity. There's a little bit of gravity, but almost none. You know what the moon's gravity is because you can measure the moon's mass and therefore its gravitational field. So it's kind of like shooting a bullet at a target that's really not all that far away. And it's basically a straight line. It's a ballistic trajectory. But the first Ranger that they sent into space to try to hit the moon missed the moon by, I think, 37,000 miles, about 18 times the diameter.
That's more than a minor error.
And it's like, and they, it wasn't that they didn't know what the calculations were. They knew all this stuff. How do you miss the moon? And the Russians missed the moon by 22,000 miles. And what happened was is they kept shooting these probes, and they kept missing the damn moon. And they even put mid-course corrections in to some of the missions, and they still missed the moon. And again, you shouldn't have to do a mid-course correction because you know how far away this is. You know where the moon's going to be in 2 or 3 days when you're going to hit it. You aim for the spot where the moon's going to be. You know how fast you're going, and you're going to hit it. There's no way to miss it. But then what finally happened was is that Ranger 4 hit the moon. But the interesting thing about Ranger 4 was is that after it got into orbit, it had a mechanical failure, an electrical failure, and it wasn't. It was a dead probe. It had no electrical activity on board at all. If that was the one that hit the moon, whereas the other ones that had all their instruments and all their navigation systems and everything working properly couldn't come anywhere near the moon. So what seems to be the trick, what caused the Explorer effect and all these other problems with these probes was that on the very early Explorer rockets, they used solid rocket motors to help boost on the upper stages to help boost the Explorer into orbit. Now, back in those days, solid rockets did not burn very smoothly. There was some inconsistency in how they burned. In other words, one rocket might burn 5% hotter or more powerful than the one next to it, or 2 or 3%. So to even that all out, they rotated the upper stage of the Explorer at 750 RPM. So what that then did is it gated more energy into the overall rocket system, and that's why Explorer ended up 600 miles higher than it was supposed to in its orbit that day. And that's why the Ranger spacecraft couldn't hit the moon, because even though they did not have rotating boosters, they'd been using liquid fuel by then, rockets by then, they had gyroscopes inside the system for their inertial navigation.
So the gyroscope was spinning
very rapidly. And then the one Ranger 4 where the gyroscopes went dead, basically went on a straight ballistic trajectory and hit the moon, the way it was, exactly the way it was supposed to.
Well, so, what I argue that they've done the calculations, that they know the weight of the capsule, they know the amount of thrust that it takes to accelerate in a certain amount of time to a certain speed. And, you know, the idea that you've got a 10,000 RPM steel wheel, like a flywheel, two of them, spinning inside this craft, that it adds more energy to the system is one thought. But, you know, what kind of energy does it add, and why does it end up helping the craft reach the moon or beyond the moon instead of hurting it? Does it, do you think, maybe change the inertia of that rocket?
Yeah. Now, inertia is a complex, it's a complex idea to explain to people, but basically a train has a lot of inertia. Once a train gets moving forward in a certain direction and it's got a lot of weight and mass, if it's here on the Earth, I guess the idea, to put it simply, and maybe you can come up with a better explanation, is it takes an awful lot of force to deflect that train off of its course, right? Because it's big, it's heavy, and it's moving at a particular speed in a certain direction. But yeah, that's exactly what seemed to happen, is that the inertia of the system, the rocket system, was affected by these little spinning devices. And Dr. De Palma's experiments showed that a small object like a gyroscope that was spinning more rapidly than a big object, like, let's say, the third stage of the Explorer rocket, did have a more profound effect in this effect that he was measuring. So it seemed to gate more energy into the system.
Well, I know that my friend Nassim Haramein has done a lot of hard research on spinning not only just mass, but various shapes at different RPMs to try to gate their effects. And then he's done some marvelous work. I guess my where I want to go with this, because there are some real breakthroughs here that are just waiting to be made. If you're able to lower inertia enough, you could get it to the point where a five-year-old could get that locomotive moving on the track. Mm-hmm. Now what you've done is you've really lowered the amount of energy that it takes to make the locomotive move. You've reduced its inertia to the point. Inertia, by the way, is resistance to movement. It's kind of like Congress. Okay, they have
that's another good way to explain it. Resistance to movement. I like that. Okay, that's a better explanation. Shorter.
And you have a really good, by the way, thought experiment in the book about being inside of a box that's traveling down the highway. Inside the box, you don't really have a sense of movement relative to the universe because you're inside this inertial universe. Mm-hmm. But if you were to slam the car to a stop, you're going to slam up against the inside of that box, and you haven't done anything but mind your own business. Somehow that inertial universe has changed. The idea that spinning bodies can have what appears to be gravitational effects over extremely astronomical distances of space and time is what really is profound here. So explain how the hyperdimensional universe really comes alive and really becomes real world for us here on this planet when we include this torsional energy that may exist 50 billion miles away.
Well, how about going to the moon without having to use a rocket? How about just getting into a little craft and spinning it around and spinning the devices inside of it, and then, you know, just giving it a little gentle nudge and having it just float slowly, gently up into space and go to the moon and use almost no fuel? I mean, the costs of going anywhere and exploring any place become absolutely zero. And again, when you talk about secret space programs, I mean, I think that the Germans were doing experiments with this kind of with spin and energy back late in World War II, and it's entirely possible that we took this technology and made, you know, essentially flying saucers out of it. And what you're talking about is flying saucer technology. And once you have that technology. Once you understand how this whole system works and how you can build devices that can utilize it, then, you know, you suddenly come into the galactic community. All of a sudden, if there are other alien races out there that have this technology, they're going to sign up and take notice and go, well, okay, I guess we have to deal with these guys now. Because you become, you get the ability to go anywhere and do anything you need to do. If you need to go to an asteroid and get some minerals that you need, you just float up there, go get it, and bring it on back. And it, you know, again, it changes the entire world. It changes everything if you can control gravity. It's phenomenal.
What an interesting idea that we don't strap human beings to a ballistic rocket. Interesting. Yep. Hey, we've got a caller, John, I believe he's in Vancouver on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks.
How are you, sir? Hope you're enjoying tonight's program. Got some input?
I'm really enjoying the program quite a bit. I didn't catch your guest name.
Oh, Mike Barra, and his book is The Choice.
Okay. Well, I just find Mike fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm just so fired up. Anyway, I'll just throw in this little bit. The impression I'm getting is that spin actually creates the dimensions and actually creates the space in which energy dissipates into. That's the thought that I'm getting.
Hmm.
Well, you know, that's one way you could put it, and the truth is, that's the kind of thing that we could test if there was more research being done in this area, and there really, unfortunately, isn't any research being done in this area. So, I don't know is that the most important thing, or does it really just matter that we know that if we spin stuff, we can negate inertia, and we can pull energy from higher dimensions, and also, what would that mean to us here on the Earth? If we had more spinning systems around us, maybe we'd all be even infinitely more in touch with that, you know, higher self that we have. Maybe we'd all become much more powerful spiritually. I don't know. That's another good thing to test, is what kind of effect can these spinning magnetic systems maybe have on our own thoughts and our own consciousness?
It could be a meditation of spinning, I suppose.
Or with spinning devices around people that are meditating. I mean, I'd love to do some more ESP research of people in rooms where they had spinning systems like gyroscopes around them and stuff. And do they score better? And, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities out here. So in terms of the details of whether that's, I don't know that it creates a new dimension. What I'm pretty sure of is that it gives you access to the energy that's flowing into this universe, and how that gives you access to that energy, and that's really, really important, because once you have energy, you know, everything becomes a lot cheaper if you can easily get the energy.
I guess what I was getting at with spin creating dimensions is I was trying to visualize like a photon not spinning and just being sent out like on a vector.
Mm-hmm.
Without spinning, I don't think it would be possible for a photon to do that. It would have to spin on its axis, and as it's spinning, that's actually helping other photons that are spinning to create the matrix of signaling that we call space-time. That's sort of how I'm looking at it. And also, like, on a vector, like, because I'm an artist, like, I'm constantly creating the illusion of 3D, and I've done it so many times now that I'm assuming that actual 3D is also being created every microsecond. So
right.
if that were true, then a photon being shot out, which is massless, it doesn't have any mass, wouldn't necessarily know where to go in a straight line. it's sort of making it up as it goes along. That's the impression that I get. So spinning on an axis would not only create space itself, but it also would help it orient itself so that it actually could do a straight line vector. If that makes sense.
I would think that there, because the photon has a specific frequency, and that frequency might be related to its spin. I'm not exactly sure, but as far as a straight line, it's going to move in a random direction from the source of the photon, whether it's an electron changing energetic states in a shell. We don't really know what direction it's gonna move out at, but we can focus it from there. We can refract it. We can reflect it. And if it bounces off an object and it's absorbed and others are not, then that object appears to be red or blue or yellow to us based on the photons that are reflected into our eye, and that's what we pick up. But it is basically information, and I'm not exactly sure if the spin is related to the energy. I know we use the Pauli exclusion principle, plus a half, minus a half, in any given system, but I'm not exactly sure how the spin relates to its energy.
I don't have anything to add to this conversation. This is why we need guys like you to come up with experiments to get into this physics, because it's like, wow, that's way deeper than I want to go. All I want to know is, okay, you spin something, you get more energy out of it. What does that mean? You know, it's funny.
Well, okay. I'm just going to throw this out, and then I'll go. I think the act of spinning helps create dimensions, and that really is pulling in an intelligence and an awareness, and that's what's
that,
missing.
I get it. That's what you're saying. I get it. Yeah, you're saying that the spin itself is what creates. It's what is pulling the intent in from above and gives the photon something to do. It tells it what to do, how it behave. I would concur with you.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, I want to clarify
that position everything.
Better. I just want to clarify that position a little bit better, because John was saying that the spin creates the dimension. I think the dimension is there, but
right.
The spin provides a portal, a pathway for that dimension to access.
And remember, all information coming from higher up is going to be experienced by us here as energy. That's just kind of the way things work. So, you know, yeah, it's information coming from somewhere above.
Stephen Hawking's, you know, lifelong battle with information and near a black hole. The idea that information can be annihilated by going into a black hole, and arguing that the amount of energy that's in the universe is fixed and that resolution cannot, you know, exceed a certain size, like the Planck distance, and so therefore the amount of energy that's in the universe is fixed. You know, that whole argument was about information going down the drain, so to speak, into a black hole and being annihilated.
Right.
That energy that exists close to a black hole is going to mirror itself, and some of that energy is going to be lost down the black hole. But what I never heard him mention, nor the plumber that argued with him for 50 years mention, is this idea that you guys are breaching upon, that information, energy, is actually coming into our universe from another hyperdimension by using the same spinning energy that the black hole is creating in their paradox.
Yep, and see, again, it's not really a paradox if you include higher dimensions at all. It's all just part of a system that you've got stuff going in, you've got stuff coming out. And there's actually been some really interesting mathematical work by people like Coxeter on topology, where they figured all this stuff out. They figured out what would the inwelling point of energy look like in a hyperdimensional system, a multidimensional system, and it would be a hexagonal shape. And you look at the north pole of Saturn, and there is this band of clouds shaped like a hexagon that has been spinning around the North Pole of Saturn for as long as we've been able to observe it. And there's nothing in any physics that we understand right now that can explain that, but there it is. And it's a signature that falls right out of this work on, I think Coxeter came up with 26 dimensions that he mathematically modeled. So, you know.
If you look at aerial photographs of Katrina, you will see that the eye of the hurricane is hexagonal in shape.
Hexagonal. Yeah, and again, explain that one to me without hyperdimensional physics, without it being based on tetrahedrons and hexagons and all that stuff that we talk about in Dark Mission very extensively. Now, since he called in, I wanted to just sort of go over this again. I'm Mike Barra. It's B-A-R-A, and you can just go to MikeBarra.com.
I'll go there.
Order the choice. And the book is called The Choice. It's on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Mm-hmm. It's in your local bookstores. I just went and found it at my local Borders and Barnes & Noble this weekend. So it's out there. You can find it.
Very nice.
Brooks.
Yes.
I just got one more thing about open universe versus closed universe. I just remember Nassim Haramein talking about vacuum fluctuations.
Vacuum fluctuations, right. Connecting
He said the density was something, according to quantum mechanics, to the tune of 10 to the 94 grams per centimeter cubed, which is
pretty close.
Infinite. More or less infinite.
It opens a really neat idea that wormholes opened to different parts of the universe would be a little bit like putting your microphone up against your speaker and then turning the amplifier up as far as it will go. It will create a feedback loop that will either clip the amplifier or destroy the speaker.
Oh, yeah.
And these vacuum fluctuations are exactly that.
One question
that kind
I had was, if we know or observe that there's more space being created, then right away that would be more energy coming into the system, since each square centimeter of a vacuum has got that fantastic amount of energy in it.
Right.
So
but how
of it every second.
The question is, how do you prove that more space is being created in a given moment that the universe
You have to look at the universe from outside the universe, so you're talking, you're looking at the Hamiltonian universe instead of Lagrangian.
I'm sorry, what?
I said you're looking at the Hamiltonian universe.
You're kind of a little bit
universe,
skeptical
here.
About that you're observation. Is that
kinetic energy and potential energy together. Sorry. I didn't mean to go there.
No, it's okay. I'm not saying I'm skeptical. I'm just wondering, how are we ever going to observe that?
Exactly. What you can do is you can observe it locally if you can open these wormholes, which I know Nassim has been working on. I know that Marco Rodin can do it for a few nanoseconds, and then his toroidal coil quits working unless he moves it to another location. Then it will work again for a few nanoseconds. He says it's a little bit like somebody's plugging a hole on the other side.
Wormholes, too, are also kind of based on the whole concept that space is actually curved, and I kind of argue in the book that it's in the choice that it's not curved. That's just what's happening is that you're having this torsional effect on free-falling objects, and that Einstein decided, because he didn't really understand torsion or be able to use higher dimensions, he had to come up with some explanation, so they came up with the curved space-time, and I'm not really buying that it's curved.
You gotta prove that one to me,
and I'm not saying I buy it yet, so.
Yeah, that's good. Okay,
right.
Well, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, and thanks for having me on as a caller.
Hey,
thanks,
no problem.
And I was just going to say, I don't want people to get the impression that The Choice is a big physics text. We've gone really heavy into the physics end of it here. We went way more heavy into the spiritual end of it than some other interviews I've done, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there, and it's a really broad overview of all kinds of different stuff.
It is, and we're gonna cover Nibiru and planets and how this hyperdimensional physics affects
it. Really
universe.
Has me going. So I'm gonna check your site out, and I'll wanna get a hold of your book.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. All right, we'll take a quick 4-minute break. Thanks, John, for the phone call. Welcome back anytime. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio. After this, take a quick break, get a glass of water. We're going to go out into space from here with more Mike Barra and his book, The Choice. It's going to be fun. Don't go away. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina, not deep beneath the earth, but directly beneath the star. By the way, if you're out and about, 6:04 or so a.m. tomorrow morning, you'll be able to see the International Space Station overhead. Take a friend out and show them that craft going overhead. It might be part of prophecy. We're going to go over that this hour with our guest, Mike Barra. His book is The Choice. His website, MikeBarra.com, is where you can buy the book. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walden Books, every good bookstore will have it. What we don't know, what we cannot know, unless they decide to tell us, is whether NASA or any other space agency has actually found either Planet X or the brown dwarf companion to our sun. Mike Barra can tell you this much, they're looking for it. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks, Brooks. Glad to be back.
Well, you never know where this program is going to go. Last hour, we got a little deep into the physics. I got a lot of chat from it. They're saying they should make a movie about us. Smart guys out there talking about all this spin theory and hyperdimensional physics. I find it fascinating and could fire up the campfire and break open some cold ones and talk about it all night. But we're limited on time. We have about 45 minutes here. You say in the book, gravity is only a weak force in a much bigger, hyperdimensional universe. And there is no reason to think that the same unseen force, torsion, that holds everything together isn't also keeping this object linked to our sun and the solar system. Let's talk a little bit about Nibiru, Planet X, what's out there.
Well, there's kind of two different, there's different ways you can look at it. I mean, what Richard's work did, what we did with in Dark Mission when we talked about hyperdimensional physics. And by the way, for people that are interested in this, the choice covers hyperdimensional physics in kind of a layman, in kind of layman's terms, more in layman's terms. But in chapter two of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, that I wrote with Richard Hoagland, we go into quite a bit more depth about the history of it and how it works, and more of it's more of a physics text part of it. You know, it's an aspect or way of looking at it. It's a bit more, it's a bit more depth than there is in the choice. But as part of what we put in Dark Mission, one of the observations that had been made early, I think it was by a Schuster, was that a planet's total luminosity, in other words, it's how bright it was in all different aspects of the light spectrum, including infrared, was related to how much spin energy it had, how much angular momentum it had. And so we took that and took a bunch of information about spin energy and luminosity, and he made a graph, and he found that all of the planets and everything fit really well on his graph. It was basically a perfect fit except for the sun, which was way off the graph. And there were two things you could conclude from that. You could conclude that our theory was wrong, that the sun was far brighter than it should be, given the amount of spin energy it had, or you could say that in the total overall system, there were a couple of planets out there that still haven't been discovered yet, at least one, maybe two. Now, congruent with that, there's the theory of Planet X. Planet X has been around forever, or at least as long as we've been, you know, talking about and trying to discover planets, and there's different theories about what it might be. Some people equate Planet X, this big planet that's beyond the orbit of Neptune, with Zechariah Sitchin's idea of Nibiru, which is this big object, this big, I don't know, could be a brown dwarf or could be a planet that comes through on this very elliptical orbit in the inner solar system every 3,600 years and, you know, basically wreaks havoc on the inner solar system. And that's one theory about it. Well, it turns out that in the hyperdimensional physics, if you were to have a Planet X, let's say 50 billion miles away, which is 550 astronomical units, and if it was truly part of this solar system and it was orbiting the sun on a 13,000 year cycle, which is about what the orbital period would be, then you could have a situation where you could have this very large planet out there adding its spin energy, which would be pretty significant, to this whole galactic alignment thing that we all know is taking place in the 2012 era. Right now we're in a phase where the Earth on December 21st on the winter solstice comes basically into alignment with the center of the galaxy. This happens only once every 26,000 years. So put all these things together and we kind of thought, well, you know, there could be an object out there, and if it was at 550 billion miles or 550 AUs, 50 billion miles away, it would have these certain characteristics. And then we went back and looked at something called the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, which was put up into orbit in 1982. Now, IRAS in 1982 discovered an object not in Sagittarius, where you would expect this planet to be, this Planet X to be, if you were hang on, I got to stop my cat from doing something here. You would expect it to be there if it was part of this sort of galactic alignment. It's exactly at the opposite end of the celestial sphere. But what they found was a very large object, basically had all the characteristics of a brown dwarf. It was very large, very cool, and it was exactly 50 billion miles out. Now, the interesting thing about this is that right after that, they stopped talking about it, and there were never really any follow-ups done, and there was eventually some paper published which, in very vague terms, said, oh, well, we think it was actually a misobservation of a distant galaxy, and that's pretty much been it. And when I wrote to Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, who did the research on it and was quoted on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times and all these other magazines and articles, he said, I don't remember anything about it. I said, oh, really, you don't remember being on the front page in an interview in the Washington Post? Okay, right, Dr. Neugebauer, I really buy that. So,
it's like I'm on there every day. How can I remember something as insignificant as being on the cover?
Insignificant as that, yeah. Right. So what that tells me is that NASA is out there looking for this, and that must mean that they understand this physics to some extent, because they went looking, you know, in the two places where you would have the most powerful astrological effect. Now, it's really interesting as you look at the astrology of it that we've talked about earlier, is that if this planet, let's call it Planet X, is 50 billion miles out, but it's between the center of the galaxy and the sun and the Earth when that 2012 alignment comes, that's going to be basically a conjunction. So in astrological terms, that's a very positive flow, a positive effect. If it's on the other side, in Orion, then it's going to be in opposition. So theoretically, it's a negative effect. But as I got into the astrology a little bit deeper towards the end of the choice, what I found and what I reported was that it could be, what's really going to happen is that this planet is most likely, if it's out there, going to amplify whatever the effect is of this pulse of energy that we're going to be getting touched by in the 2012 transitional period.
Hmm. Well, that could be good and that could be bad. You know, what did the Mayans say? Well, I was going to say, we've had Jose Arguez on the program, and we talked
right.
a little bit about what was on the tomb of Palenque, mm-hmm. or Pakal, Pakal's tomb lid in Palenque, and how it talked about this alignment with the rift in the Milky Way,
mm-hmm.
and how this... very intense band of, shall we call it, gravitational energy, a pulse, as it were, is coming from the center of the galaxy. Maybe it's always there, and we just kind of cross the speed bump as we go through in the precession.
Right.
But that it has potentially cataclysmic effects on the planet itself. Are we just along for the ride? I mean, if Nemesis is out there, as you say in your book, whether it is in Orion or Sagittarius, is it going to force us to make a choice?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying is going to happen. And what I think we make a pretty good case for, what I make a pretty good case for in the choice and what Richard's still working on, is that this is actually a torsion energy. It's a torsion beam. And there's even a Mayan legend, I think it's at the monument at Tortuguero, which says that on December 21st, 2012, what will happen is that Quetzalcoatl will ride a serpent rope from the center of the galaxy, and he will manifest here in 3D to pass judgment on us. And that's what's going to happen in 2012, according to the Mayans. Now, there's a lot of interesting little clues in there. A serpent rope, what do serpents do? They spin and they coil. So again, you've got this coiling, spinning, spiraling, torsional movement, and that's obviously to me a reference to this torsion physics that I think I've figured out. And Quetzalcoatl is going to come here and he's going to judge us. Now, when people hear that, they immediately assume the worst. They assume, you know, biblical judgment. You're good, you're bad, you go to heaven, you go to hell. Everybody gets destroyed, and we all start over again. But I don't think that's what's happening. If you look at the other astrological alignments in the 2012 era, they all point to polarization in our consciousness, polarization in our ways of thinking. And people are going to have to choose whether they're, I think, of the spirit or of the material world. And the majority of us that vote are going to basically set out the intent of the planet. So what I think Quetzalcoatl is going to judge when he gets here is not us. It's not up to the energy pulse. This torsion energy is neutral. It's going to judge what our spiritual intent is for this planet, and that's what we're going to get. That's the result we're going to get. So when I talk about the Mayan judgment and what their talking about, I think that's why it's really important that we all start to become consciously aware of our own spirit and to be connected to it and to start thinking about with intention how we want to live and the kind of world that we want to live in. And the more positive that is, the more positive the results. I think if you look at these catastrophe scenarios, they're all definitely plausible. Pole shifts, earthquakes, I think I make a pretty good case that some of the recent earthquakes that have happened in January and December are because of these torsion effects that we're getting hit, this beam of energy we're getting hit with on a fairly regular basis. So to me, what's going to happen is that we're going to get exactly what we intend and exactly what we ask for. And that's why I think it's really important that in the end, we focus inwardly and spiritually. And I think that will hopefully bring everything to a positive conclusion this time around rather than a negative one.
Well, I like the idea that, you know, you've written the book, The Choice. You've got obviously a great voice and a great venue for talking about it. The idea is going out there through a lot of other portals as well. And I say the idea, I mean this positive idea that our intention, our frequency has an effect. And now I like the idea, and I think it's very powerful, that this torsion energy, this spin energy, allows us evidently to have a much more profound effect on the universe than we think we have. In the scriptures, they use the mathematically profound number of 144,000. It can be argued that in Hebrew, this just means a large number. It's a square of 12,000. It's a square of 100 of 1,200. And that just means a large number. I think you'll agree, there are a lot more than 144,000 people on the earth that are doing this, that have it right, that are putting on a regular focused basis a positive energy out there. But what I mean by positive, I don't mean they're all wishing for Ferraris or Porsches or immense wealth. They may have actually transcended that, where wealth in that sense of the word doesn't mean anything to them anymore. That wealth to them means to the benefit of the human race, to
right.
peace, to mercy, to a more magnanimous energy toward everyone. And that's the kind of thing that I get, and I love the way you put this in the book, that music has a tendency to do that to you, and not just hymns, but trance music and, you know, this very powerful harmonic music that we're beginning to get now on our radio. It's not just simple love songs, powerful lyrics, you know, tremendous art that's coming out now, having great effects on the consciousness of the race. And I don't think there's any small effect on the idea that we can all communicate instantaneously around the planet. We can get an intention going so fast, faster than ever before in this planet.
Right.
We can have an effect.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that bugs me about, you know, some of the people that are out there on this 2012 stuff, I like, you know, like David Wilcock, who I really like and respect, but, you know, he tells people that, look, you know, we're just going to, it's all just going to happen. We don't have to do anything. We're all just going to get together in 2012 and ride off into the sunset singing Kumbaya. And what I'm saying is, no, that's not the way it's going to turn out unless we choose it, unless we actively pick that. And it's also not, I guess I would say, not accurate to say that I agree that simply meditating or going inward is all that's necessary and having happy feelings. I mean, a lot of the point of yoga, for instance, is to empty your mind. And I'm saying, no, you don't want to empty your mind. You want to get to a peaceful place, and then you want to actually set an intention out there. You want to actually vote. You want to actually say to Quetzalcoatl when he gets here, well, I'm going to choose, you know, light and peace and selflessness and not selfishness. So I think it's really important for us to understand that we are here to choose, I think, in this time. I think all of us are here at this really special time to make a choice, but we actually have to make it. If you don't if you don't make some sort of choice, if you don't say, I would like there to be, you know, everybody on the planet to be fed and housed and all that kind of thing, then it may not happen, and we may get some of the bad scenarios that look like they may have happened to previous versions of our human civilization in the past.
Well, I want to make sure that, you know, we don't become deceived here, that everyone that's here on the planet right now is 100% responsible for their own life condition.
Right.
We are not handed a bad life against our will. We made choices, whether it was to come here, to be born where we're born, or to exist the way we exist. And whether we're in heaven or whether we are in hell on this earth is completely our choice. I, for one, am in the Mike Barra camp on this. I don't think that we sit idly by and ride the bus. I think that we each have steering wheels and a set of pedals in front of our seat, and we need to use them. That's just my thought. And I
concur with you. And the other thing that I think separates the choice from this other 2012 stuff that's out there is that I'm also saying that because the physics has to do with astrology, planetary alignments, there's certain dates and times when our ability to affect change, as I spoke about earlier, is amplified. And
yes,
what I'd like to do is like, as you suggested in your previous question, is to try to get people to say, hey, let's all get together during the eclipse of December 21st, 2012. Let's connect by the internet. Let's get people in cities all over the world. Let's create a second harmonic convergence, because Jose created the first one. Let's create a second one, and let's do a whole bunch of them on all of these key dates, the Venus transit and the May 20th eclipse over Mount Shasta. Let's all get together and connect the world and get a lot more than 144,000. Let's get 144 million or 1.44 billion people together.
There you go. Now let's talk a little bit about those special events. You breezed over them really quickly, assuming that everyone who listens to this program knows about them. One is the Venus transit. Explain that. When is it going to happen? How often does it happen? What happens when it does occur?
Well, it's really interesting because the Mayans considered the Venus transits to be really, really crucially important. I mean, they tracked the passages of Venus with tremendous accuracy. And it's really interesting that the start of the current calendar cycle and the start of the current yuga cycle both corresponded to around 3102 to 3114 BC, which is, there was a Venus transit that took place right during that period. So what seems to happen, and what a Venus transit is basically, is a little mini eclipse where Venus passes between the Earth and the Sun, and they happen, well, the simplest way to explain it is about four times every 242 years, I think. So what happens is you have two transits of Venus within a 12-year, within an 8-year period. For instance, the last one was in 2004. The next one will be in 2012. And if you look at Venus transits, the last few Venus transits, they seem to have had a really dramatic effect on our consciousness. We had one right before the American Revolution, about 5 or 10 years before the American Revolution. We had Venus transits back in the 1860s, where we had the Civil War, and then we had this sort of birth of real spiritual enlightenment that took place all around the continent. So as you look at these Venus transits, what you're seeing is that they seem to have an effect on our way of thinking, and they seem to happen during periods of transition. Now, 2004 to 2010, there's been a lot of change, a lot of transition, a lot of hierarchies and structures seem to be, if not collapsing, they seem to be teetering and weakening. And so I think what that implies is what the Mayans told us about, which is that when you come to this time in space, things are going to really change rather dramatically, and you need to be prepared for that transition. So to me, it's really, you know, they seem to be really, really crucially important in terms of dictating what's going to happen here with us or what our opportunities are in 2012. Now, the interesting thing about this next Venus transit is it takes place in June, about 2 weeks after a major eclipse that starts out off the coast of China, centers over the international dateline, the exact midpoint between east and west, and then ends on over Mount Shasta, which is, of course, a very sacred, important, you know, place to a lot of ancient cultures here here in the western United States. So what it looks like you're going to have is all of these major astronomical events affecting our consciousness. We're going to get hit by wave after wave of energy, and the likely outcome of that is that things, our way of thinking is going to change very dramatically.
All right, well, maybe that's what we need to do, is change our way of thinking. We still have time. We've got a little less than 2 years, but we can get this together. May of 2012, June of 2012, we've got a full lunar eclipse that is going to be visible, not only in China, but ending on that same day on Mount Shasta in North America. We're going to be able to see this full lunar eclipse. Now, does that mean that the moon is going to turn to blood? This is like a fulfillment of prophecy?
Yeah, to some extent, you can look at it that way. And the key thing to remember, though, is that they some of these signals and messages, I think, have gotten distorted over the centuries. You've had people writing these stories, and you know, I don't think it necessarily means plagues and floods and everything. I mean, remember, if you really buy into these end time scenarios, that everything's really going to go to hell in a handbasket, it really hasn't happened yet. I mean, I don't see worldwide droughts and floods and famine. It just really doesn't exist. I mean, yeah, you've had some local situations that aren't too pleasant, and the weather seems to be a bit unstable, but that may have more to do just with what the sun's putting out than it does anything else. And certainly it's not epic by historical standards. So
I like the idea that you use the word prophecy. Prophecy, by definition, is a conditional prediction. If you keep doing this, then this is going to happen.
Right.
Well, the fact that we've had that information in our hands for thousands of years means that as a race, we have been empowered by a message from the future. And by being so empowered, we have made other choices, which have chosen another future. So the fact that we don't have frogs dropping out of the sky or boils popping out on our skin or seas leaving their bounds could be a result of the choices that we as a race have made over the last 2,000 years, because we've had this knowledge. We have tempered our warlike tendencies just because of these words.
Well, and that's exactly what Jose Arguelles was trying to get everybody to do with the first harmonic convergence back in 1987. And, you know, he basically specifically said, if we do this convergence, if we get these people together, then we will be able to mitigate the effects, the dire predictions of the Dresden Codex, you know, by a factor of hundreds. And he achieved that, because we really had a period of great peace and prosperity after that, very little war that was going on. So what I'm trying to say to people is, we need more of these kinds of events, and we need to do them now over the next couple of years as we're leading up to 2012. Now, I'm not sure that right on December 21st, 2012 is when everything's going to go down. The Mayans say that, but I'm not really sure that that's when it's going to go down. But I do say that we're in a period where we could be going for up to, gosh, probably 2023, when the Yuga cycles really come to an end, where we're going to really have not necessarily chaos, but transition. And the more harmonic convergences we can have between now and then, especially on eclipses and when those things are going on, the more we'll be able to impact how this comes out and turn it into something positive.
Well, I'm still going to be here, so we'll be focused on that. Now, there are things that the less spiritually active are doing to mitigate this as well. One of the ideas is that there's going to be huge solar conflagration. Some great flare is going to leap out into space, and the fact that we're aligned with the galactic center is going to cause this flare to be accelerated and amplified toward Earth, and it's going to end up in what they call the Z-pinch flare. Well, that very well could happen, but, you know, we have a pretty good magnetosphere around the Earth. We also have another field around the Earth called the ionosphere.
Right.
And the less spiritually awake might be taking a more electromechanical method of strengthening the Earth's defense. Let's talk about HARP a little bit.
Yeah, this is interesting because what I'm trying to tell people is, you know, governments, everybody's, the conspiracy theorists, they're all looking to the government to do something, you know, save us, use your technology, get the flying saucers to come down and save us. And you can only do so much with technology. The missing part of the equation is us. But governments are, I think, trying to do something. They're aware that these changes are going to take place. They're aware that, you know, this period of transition could have all these different physical events happening. So what HARP is it's a device ostensibly to communicate with submarines from great distances with ultra-low frequency signals, but it also can do some things like punch holes in the ionosphere or heat the ionosphere or harden the ionosphere. Now, the ionosphere is pretty much the last layer of defense against solar flares, and I think it's really interesting as you look around the world that there are these HARP-like devices, one placed here over the United States and Canada, one in Europe over Central Europe, and one in Russia over Russia. And the United States has even built a second one down in Puerto Rico in Arecibo. So what that means is I think what these devices really do, and they put out way, way more power than they say in their official specs, they are designed to harden up the last line of defense in case you do have this massive solar flare. But I got to be honest with you, Brooks. I look at the Z-pinch scenario. It's pretty scary. I suspect it probably has happened in the past. But it seems to me that if that was really what was going to happen, we'd be seeing a lot more out of the sun than we have. I know it's been more active lately, but it's really not putting out a whole lot of energy the last couple of years. So, I mean, you know more about this than I do. Is it really ramping up that much, or is there anything unusual about what the sun's doing right now?
Yeah, there's a lot unusual about what the sun's doing right now. The late arrival of what we call high latitude reverse polarity sunspots, which marks the beginning of the next solar cycle, really had solar scientists baffled. Now we have the SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory. It's way better than SOHO. It gives us a great view of the sun. It's like having a Coronado scope on steroids.
Right.
It's a stereoscopic telescope, so we get to look at things dimensionally instead of a flat screen kind of a digital camera would take. And we've been able to map things like the internal jet stream, and now we see how these magnetic filaments cause really magnetic tsunamis across the surface of the sun.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Even with all of this observation, solar scientists are really confused as to why we are not way, way more active on the sunspots, on the flares. The sun is very quiet, and it's having its effect even on the heliosphere itself. The galactic wind is having an effect on the solar wind, what we call the heliosphere, or this a sun-like bubble of wind that's around the solar system, that's energy that emanates out from the sun 360 degrees in all directions, but it's being dragged out like a bullet shape or a teardrop in space because the galactic wind is overcoming the solar wind. We were really amazed to see both Voyager craft pop out of the heliosphere far quicker than we thought, because we had our estimates of what size the heliosphere might be, but the two Voyagers gave us a new picture of that. And then when they got outside the solar system, outside the heliosphere, they were in the neighborhood of clouds of encapsulated high-energy particles that shouldn't be there. We are in a neighborhood of energy that's making our sun behave differently than we've ever seen it behave before. And you might think, well, gee, we've only been looking at it for 30 or 40 years. Not so. We have records going back thousands and thousands of years of solar activity. There was a solar flare in 1829. Now, admittedly, it only rattled telegraph wires, but it did shock people that were working on those telegraph things, and it caused a lot of fires. If that happened today, I mean, our internet was down in the building downtown Charlotte the other day for almost a whole day. I thought the world was coming to an end.
Yeah. Yeah, no. It is amazing how dependent we are on this. And you would hope that they being the government and the people on the inside would really be aware of this and not want to alarm people and would be taking measures to harden things up. I know one of the things that could happen is transformers could explode all over the place. And
there's not a lot of spare transformers out there, people. If a transformer goes, you're looking at 1 to 2 years to get a transformer back in place. Not the ones up on the poles, the ones in the substations.
Yeah, and we really should be working on hardening those and building more of them. And, it really is an issue because, you know, some people say, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Daniel Brinkley, but he says, you know, we're going to get hit with a big flare and the lights are going to go out for a week or 10 days. Or I actually said, I think it might be longer than that, Daniel. But,
eight, ten years,
it's going to give us a chance to take a pause and breathe and all think about things and think about where we're at and think about whether we want to keep going in the same direction. And that's an interesting idea. Maybe it will be kind of a gift to maybe not make the world, we won't feel like the world's ending, but to maybe make everybody pause and think and turn inward a little bit. So,
it depends on how prepared people are, because if food stops running and fuel stops running and air conditioning quits blowing and refrigeration goes out, there's going to be a lot more than a pause.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a bad thing. So, you know, I don't know what the plans are. I assume that there is some research that's been done on this and that they are taking measures to fix this stuff. And if they're not, they should be. But I don't know. The Obama administration seems intent on spending money on everything but what they should be spending it on. And I don't know if I really...
Well, what I do like about...
I'm not very optimistic that really they're going to take care of that stuff. So
what I do like about your book, and I know this, you know, isn't a physicist saying this, but one idea as to why the sun is so quiet is because we are, even in the United States and in other countries too, there are a lot of spiritually awake people.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be what you call a movement, but there is hardly a hamlet in this country that does not have people that have either read this book, The Choice, or will read it, would pick it up if it was in their bookstore. They're ready to hear it. And that energy, 100, 150 watts at a time, is resonating with the sun, just like the other planets that are spinning out there, aligning with the sun, causing solar flares that RCA made their, or Nelson made his observation of. We are also having an effect on the solar system. The more of us that are enlightened, the easier it is going to be to pass through this time.
I agree with you, and you know, I think you have to understand that this solar flare thing, it's been out there actually for quite a while, and I think that if you've got people actually wishing and hoping and saying, gosh, I hope that doesn't happen, and even those people aren't necessarily specifically praying with intention to help the sun stay calm and don't get crazy on us, even those people are going to help just by saying, you know, I wish that wouldn't happen, rather than worrying about it or being afraid of it, just saying, let's not do that, let's not have that happen. So I agree with you. I think that all this conscious awareness is going to have a positive effect on it. And I think that may be the reason why, because I don't know that there's really a good explanation, even in the hyperdimensional physics, for why things aren't more ramped up than they are.
Hmm. Well, here's the challenge. It's a challenge for authors and lecturers like Mike Barra. It's a challenge for talk radio like X Squared Radio or Coast to Coast or any of the others. This is the challenge we're facing. And you quote this in the book, and I was going to paraphrase it, but it's so short and it's so apropos, I thought I would just read it with your permission. You quote Professor Robert Temple, fellow of the British Royal Astronomical Society. He once put it in his book called The Sirius, that's Sirius like the star, The Sirius Mystery. In my opinion, a mind is healthy when it can perform symbolic acts within mental frameworks which are not immediately obvious. A mind is diseased when it is no longer, it no longer comprehends this kind of linkage and refuses to acknowledge any basis for such symbolic thinking. The 20th century, that's the last century for those in Ohio, the 20th century specializes in producing diseased minds of the type I refer to, minds which uniquely combine ignorance with arrogance. The 20th century's hardcore hyper-rationalist would deride a theory of correspondences in daily life and ritual as primitive superstition. However, the rationalist's comment is not one upon symbolic thinking, but upon himself. And I think you'll agree with this, acting as a label to define him as one of the walking dead. That's the difference between the spiritually awake and those thousands of people that you pass every day commuting to work one at a time in their gasoline-powered cars, staring out the windshield, completely oblivious of the symbolism of their existence.
Yeah, listening to sports talk radio or political radio and all the arguments and all that stuff. And yeah, I thought that quote was worth putting in there because that's really those types of, that's how you end up with Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design, and the silly conclusion that he comes to, that there's no God out there. You know, that's how you end up with my first two reviews on Amazon.com. Of course, there's a couple of guys probably following me around from my conspiracy days, and they both reviewed the book, gave it one star, and attacked me. You know, usually they attack you for things you did, never actually said. They just put words in your mouth and then deride you for it. But the one guy admitted he hadn't read the book yet, but he was just sure I was wrong. I just thought, wow, okay. You know, I mean, to me, it's like you. Because there's these laws of physics and there's all these things that we know, and where do I get off challenging these people that I'm challenging and so forth? And it's like, well, anybody can challenge Stephen Hawking. They just have to have the right information and go at it. So it's like, it's funny. I just thought, yeah, there's some people that are just so enmeshed in scientific materialism and treat these scientists as if they're priests. And their words as if they're scripture, that, you know, I just don't think you're going to reach them. And I'm not trying to reach them. I'm trying to reach the people that are at least open to new ideas and, you know, have some connection with their heart. And that's the most important aspect of being alive, I think.
Well, I think the great fear that's out there, and it's being perpetrated and it's being amplified, I think, by the administration, the great fear is that you are in scarcity, and we're here to help.
Right.
I think you've heard me say it before. There's a big difference between health insurance and health care. You know, I raised four kids, had two of them at home, took care of all the deliveries, all the skin, knees, broken bones, stitches, you name it, and never had health insurance. But I could afford health care. And that's the big difference. If you think that you're in scarcity, ask yourself this. Compared to what?
Yeah.
Don't look in the garage for the absence of toys and say, I live in scarcity. Don't look at the age of the clothes in your closet, which you probably have more than enough to wear, and say, I live in scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the kind of scarcity we're talking about. Scarcity of dreams. Scarcity of hope, and worst of all, scarcity of love is what we're talking about. Bulk up on those things, and I think we can fix this. What do you say, Mike?
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely, wholeheartedly agree with you. And when you give up responsibility for caring for yourself, then you're giving up your dreams, because the people that you give that responsibility up to are going to give you back what they want, not what you want. So if you want your life to be better, if you want, you know, your life to be different than it is, then go out and make it that way. Go claim it for yourself, and don't expect other people to give it to you, because they're not going to give you what you want. They're going to give you what they want to give you.
And don't blame anyone else for the way your life is either.
Yeah.
Great book, Mike. I enjoyed it. I've tattered it. and it's going to go in the bookcase in that condition, I'm afraid. I appreciate the read. I appreciate you coming on the program. I really enjoyed it, and I definitely would love to collaborate with you on your documentary. I think that'd be a blast.
Yeah, I'd love to have you. I'd love to have you in it. The only complication is that you're in North Carolina, and we're out here on the West Coast. But we'll
no problem. No problem at all. I have friends in Santa Monica. I can hitchhike out there.
Oh, okay. All right. Hanging out with Whitley Strieber, huh?
No, John Riley, owner of Zero Point Research there.
He's a
former Lockheed Skunk Works guy that's working on his own, does a lot of great stuff. In fact, we're planning a trip to Egypt on November 8th. We're going to be sailing the Nile on 11/11. It's going to be a blast. You should come.
Oh, that would be spectacular. I'm really jealous. That sounds like great fun.
Hey, we have a space. We have a space for two. You should come.
Well, yeah, okay. I'll put some thought into it. I'll put some energy into that and see what happens.
Yeah, very good. That's all I ask.
Right.
That's all I ask. Just put a little energy out there. Okay. And so you're going to speak. You're speaking at the Conscious Life Expo coming up in
weekend, LA. A week from today on Sunday, the 17th, at the Conscious Life Expo at the LAX Hilton Hotel.
Yeah.
It's a great, if you're in the LA area, it's a great expo to come out to. There's all kinds of terrific speakers there, as usual. And it's a twice yearly event. So you come out and see that. I'm going to have a book signing there, and I'll do the lecture. And it's the first one that I've really done since the book came out, and it's got going to have a bunch of new information in it that's in the book that's not in some of my previous lectures that are on YouTube and so forth. And you can pick up The Choice at Barnes & Noble or Borders or, like you say, Walden Books, or go to barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com.
Or MikeBarra.com.
MikeBarra.com, B as in boy, A-R-A, and one R, and you can go find The Choice, and hopefully you'll find it an entertaining read, if nothing else.
I have. I highly endorse it. We'll have it listed on our website. This show will be posted in about an hour at xsquaredradio.com, and you'll be able to listen to it in its entirety for those of you who are subscribers. If you're listening free live, which we are always free live worldwide, and you're not a subscriber, it's easy to do. Just click on the subscribe button. It's $20 a year, which is less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. And you get to listen to great guests like Mike Barra. All right. I appreciate it very much, sir. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be in touch.
I appreciate the opportunity, Brooks. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. All right, Earth Explorers, we will be with you next week right here on X Squared Radio. I appreciate you out there listening live. Those of you that are listening Monday morning, by the way, it's Columbus Day. Some of you will not be listening. You'll be listening on Tuesday because your place of business is closed. But if it isn't, we appreciate you. Don't forget, we do have the Egypt trip coming up. If you want to learn more about it, click on the 1111 Gateway Mystery School banner there at X Squared Radio. Get a hold of us. There's still time. I think we have room for four. We will be sailing the Nile. No, we will not be on a big cruise ship. We'll be on a very small ship, specially made for this journey. We're going to go places that you won't go with the big tours, and you'll be with myself and John Riley. And you should have a wonderful time and understand the ancient part of Egypt. And we'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.